Chapter 5. A Broken Crown. Wide and tall as the corridors were, they felt close, and dim, despite tall gilded stand lamps with mirrors on every branch, lit wherever daylight could not penetrate. Tapestries hung few and far between on the walls, scenes of hunt or battle with people and animals, arranged more precisely than ever nature had. Scattered niches held bowls and vases, and now and then a small statue, in gold or silver or alabaster, but even the statues seemed to emphasize that they were stone or metal, as if the sculptors had tried to banish curves. The city's hush was magnified here. The sound of their boots on the floor tiles echoed, a hollow foreboding march, and Perrin did not think it was so to his ears alone. Loyals quivered at every other step, and he peered down crossing corridors, as though wondering what might leap out. Min held herself stiffly and took ginger steps, grimacing ruefully when she glanced at Rand. She seemed to make an effort not to walk closer to him, and not particularly pleased with herself over it. The young Kyrianen started off swaggering like peacocks, but that arrogance faded as the drumming of their heels reverberated. Even the maidens felt it. Sulin was the only one whose hand did not sometimes rise toward the veil hanging down her chest. There were servants everywhere, of course, pale, narrow-faced men and women in dark coats and dresses with the rising sun on the left breast, and sleeves striped in Kolaver's colors. Some gaped in recognition as Rand passed by. A handful dropped to their knees, heads bowed. Most went on about their tasks after a small pause for deep bow or curtsy. It was just as in the courtyard. Show proper respect to your betters, whoever they are. Obey them, and otherwise ignore what they do, and perhaps you will not be entangled in it. It was a way of thinking that set Perrin's teeth on edge. Nobody should have to live that way. Two fellows in Kolaver's livery, standing before the gilt-covered doors to the Grand Hall of the Sun, frowned at the sight of the maidens, and maybe at the young Kyrianen. Older folk usually looked askance at the younglings carrying on every bit as much as the Aiel did. More than one parent had tried to put an end to it, had ordered sons or daughters to give over, instructed armsmen and servants to chase off others like-minded sons and daughters, like common vagrants or street ruffians. Perrin would not have been surprised if these doormen slanted their gilded staffs to stop Solanda and her friends from entering through the open doorways, nobility or not, and perhaps even the maidens. Few Kyrianen still dared call Aiel savages, not where they could be heard, but most thought it. The pair gathered themselves, drew deep breaths, and saw Rand over the maidens' heads. Their eyes nearly popped out of their faces. Each man glanced sideways at the other, and then they were on their knees. One stared fixedly at the floor. The other squeezed his eyes shut, and Perrin heard him praying under his breath. "So I am loved," Rand said softly. He hardly sounded himself. Min touched his arm, her face pained. Rand patted her hand without looking at her, and for some reason that seemed to pain her even more. The Grand Hall of the Sun was immense, with an angle-vaulted ceiling a full 50 paces high at its peak, and great golden lamps hung on gilded chains thick enough to move the gates of a fortress. It was immense, and it was full. People crowding among massive square columns of blue-black veined marble that stood in two rows to either side of the center aisle. The folk at the rear noticed the newcomers first. In long coats and short, some in bright colors or embroidered, some travel-worn, they stared curiously, intently. The few women in the back of the hall wore riding dresses and had faces as hard as the men, gazes as direct. Hunters for the horn, Perrin thought. Dobrain had said that every noble who could be there would, and most hunters were nobly born, or claimed to be. Whether or not they recognized Rand, they sensed something, hands feeling for swords and daggers that were not there this evening. More hunters than not sought adventure and a place in the histories along with the Horn of Valir. Even if they did not know the Dragon Reborn, they knew danger when they saw it. The others in the Grand Hall were less attuned to danger, or rather, more to intrigues and plots than to open hazard. Perrin was a third of the way down the long center aisle, close on Rand's heels, before gasps ran through the chamber like a wind. Pale Kyrianan lords with colorful slashes across the chests of their dark silk coats, some with the front of their heads shaved and powdered, Kyrianan ladies with stripes on their dark high-necked gowns and lace falls covering their hands, their hair in intricate towers that often added a good foot of height. Tyran high lords and lords of the land, with oiled beards trimmed to points, in velvet hats and coats of red and blue, and every color, with puffy, satin-striped sleeves. Tyran ladies, in even more colorful gowns, with wide lace ruffs and close caps studded with pearls and moonstones, fire drops and rubies. They knew Perrin, and they knew Dobrain, and even Havian and Min. But most importantly, they knew Rand. A ripple of knowing that kept pace up the hall with him. Eyes widening, jaws dropping, they went so stiff Perrin almost thought the Ashaman had bound them like the guards outside the palace. The chamber was a sea of sweet perfumes, and beneath that, undercurrents of salty sweat. But through it oozed fear, a quivering sort of smell. His attention was all on the far end of the hall, though, on the deep blue marble dais where the sun throne stood, shining like its namesake with gilt, the wavy rayed rising sun huge atop the high back. Kolaver rose slowly, peering down the aisle over Rand's head. Her nearly black dress bore not a single stripe of nobility, but the great mass of curls rising above her head had to have been dressed around the crown she wore, the rising sun in gold and yellow diamonds. Seven young women flanked the sun throne in dark bodiced gowns with lace snugged under their chins and skirts striped vertically in Kolaver's yellow and red and silver. It seemed that Kyrianan fashion was different for the queen and for the queen's attendants. A flicker of motion behind the throne picked out an eighth woman, hidden, but Perrin cared about neither Kolaver nor anyone else except the woman to her ultimate right. Fael. Her slightly tilted eyes fastened on him, dark liquid moons, yet not a line altered of her coolly decorous expression. If anything, her face grew tighter. His nose strained for the scent of her, but the perfume was too strong, and the fear. She had a reason for being there on the dais, a good reason. She did. Rand touched Sulin's sleeve. "Wait here," he said. Scowling, the scar on her leathery face standing out as white as her hair, she scanned his face, then nodded with obvious reluctance. Her free hand gestured anyway, and another gasp ran through the chamber as the maidens veiled. It was almost laughable. The eight men in black coats trying to watch everywhere at once could probably kill them all before the first maiden drove home a spear, but no one knew who or what they were. No one looked at them twice, a handful of men with their swords sheathed, only at the maidens. And Rand. Hadn't they noticed that not a one of those men sweated a drop more than Rand? Perrin felt as if he were bathing in his. Stepping past the maidens, with Min still close beside him, Rand stopped as first Perrin, then Dobrain and Havian joined him. And Aram, of course, like Perrin's shadow. Rand studied them each in turn, nodding slowly. He studied Perrin longest, and took the longest time to nod. The gray-haired Kyrianan and the young Mayenner wore faces like death. Perrin did not know how his own looked, but his jaw was locked tight. No one was going to harm Fael, no matter what she had done, no matter why, no matter what he had to do to stop it. Their boots drummed loud in the silence as they crossed the huge golden mosaic of the rising sun in the blue-tiled floor and approached the throne. Hands gripping her skirts, Kolaver wet her lips, and her eyes darted between Rand and the doors behind him. "Looking for Aes Sedai?" Rand's voice echoed. He smiled unpleasantly. "I sent them to the Aiel camp. If the Aiel can't teach them manners, no one can." A shocked murmur rose and fell raggedly. Fear became stronger than the perfumes in Perrin's nose. Kolaver gave a start. "Why would I..." Drawing a deep breath, she gathered dignity. A more than handsome woman in her middle years, without a touch of gray in her dark hair, she bore a regal presence that had nothing to do with the crown. She had been born to command, to reign, so she thought. And her eyes, weighing and measuring, betrayed a hard intelligence. "My Lord Dragon," she said, making a curtsy so deep it nearly mocked itself, "I welcome you back. Carrion welcomes you back." The way she said it, she seemed to be repeating herself. Slowly Rand climbed the steps of the dais. Min half made to follow him, then folded her arms. Perrin did follow, to be near Fael, but only part way. It was her gaze that stopped him, a gaze that probed every bit as much as Colivert's. At him, as much as at Rand. Perrin wished he could smell her. Not to try discovering why or what, just for the smell of her. The wash of perfumes and fright was too great. Why did she not speak? Why did she not come to him, or smile? Just a smile. Colivert stiffened a splinter's worth, but only that. Her head came no more than level with Rand's chest, though her towered hair rose almost as tall as he. His eyes slid from her face, and along the women lined up on either side of the throne. He might have paused on Fael. Perrin could not be sure. Rand rested his hand on one heavy arm of the sun throne. "You know I mean this for Elaine Trakand." His voice was emotionless. "My Lord Dragon," Colivert replied smoothly, "Carrion had been too long without a ruler. A Carrionan ruler. You yourself said you have no interest in the sun throne for yourself. Elaine Trakand would have had some claim." A small, quick gesture dismissed such a claim. "If she were alive. Rumor says she is dead, like her mother." A dangerous thing to say. A good many rumors said Rand had killed both mother and daughter. The woman was no coward. "Elaine is alive." The words were still flat as a planed board, but Rand's eyes burned. Perrin could not pick out his smell any more than Fael's, but he did not need his nose to know rage bottled right in front of him. "She will have the crowns of Andor and of Carrion."
"My Lord Dragon, what is done cannot be undone. If anything has offended you..."
For all her dignity, all her courage, Colivert made a visible effort not to flinch as Rand reached out and took hold of the sun crown. There was a loud crack of metal snapping, and the crown flexed, hardly disarraying her tower of curls as it pulled away, slowly straightening. A few of the brilliant yellow stones popped from their settings and fell. He held up the stretched arc of metal, and slowly it bent back on itself until the ends met, and... Maybe the Ashaman could see what happened, could understand, but to Perrin, one moment the crown was broken, the next it was whole again. No one among the nobles made a sound, not even a shuffling of boots. Perrin thought they might be afraid, too. To his nose, stark terror was stronger than any other scent now. It did not quiver, it spasmed wildly. "Whatever can be done," Rand said softly, "can be undone." Colivert's face drained of blood. The few wisps of hair that had escaped her coiffure made her seem wild, at bay. Swallowing, she opened her mouth twice before any words came out.
"My Lord Dragon."
It was a breathy whisper, but as she went on, her voice became stronger, and edged with desperation. She seemed to forget anyone else was present.
"I have kept the laws you made, maintained your policies, even those that go against the ancient laws of Carrion, against all custom."
She probably meant the laws that had let a noble kill a farmer or craftsman and walk away.
"My Lord Dragon, the Sun Throne is yours to give. I know that. I was wrong to take it without your leave. But I have the right to it, by birth and blood. If I must have it from your hand, then give it to me by your hand. I have the right."
Rand only looked at her. He said nothing. He seemed to be listening, but not to her. Aaron cleared his throat. Why was Rand dragging this out? It was done, or nearly. Let whatever else had to be done be done. Then he could take Fayil away, where they could talk.
"Did you have the right to murder Lord Maringill and High Lord Mylan?"
Perrin demanded. There was no doubt in his mind that she had had it done. They had been her biggest rivals for the throne. Or she and they thought they were, anyway. Why was Rand just standing there? He knew all of this.
"Where is Berylaine?"
Before the name was off his tongue, he wanted to call it back. Fayil only glanced at him, her face still a cool mask of propriety, but that glance could have set water aflame. A jealous wife is like a hornet's nest in your mattress, the saying went. No matter how you twitched, you got stung.
"You dare accuse me of so vile a crime?" Colbert demanded. "There is no proof. There can be no proof. Not when I am innocent."
Abruptly, she seemed to become aware of where she was, of the nobles crowded shoulder to shoulder among the columns, watching and listening. Whatever else could be said of her, she did have courage. Standing straight, she did her best to stare Rand in the eye without tilting her head too far back.
"My Lord Dragon, 9 days ago at sunrise I was crowned Queen of Carrion according to the laws and usages of Carrion. I will keep my oath of fealty to you, but I am Queen of Carrion."
Rand only stared at her, silent. And troubled, Perrin would have said.
"My Lord Dragon, I am Queen, unless you would rip all our laws away."
Still silence from Rand, and an unblinking stare. Why doesn't he end it? Perrin wondered.
"These charges against me are false. They are mad."
Only that silent stare for answer. Colbert moved her head uneasily.
"Anura, advise me. Come, Anura, advise me."
Perrin thought she spoke to one of the women with Fayil, but the woman who stepped from behind the throne did not wear the striped skirts of an attendant. A broad face with a wide mouth and a beak of a nose regarded Rand from beneath dozens of long, thin, dark braids. An ageless face. To Perrin's surprise, Javian made a sound in his throat and began grinning. His own hackles were standing straight.
"I cannot do this, Colbert,"
the Aes Sedai said in a Tarabonner accent, shifting her gray-fringed shawl.
"I fear I have allowed you to misperceive my relationship to you."
Drawing a deep breath, she added,
There is no need for this, Master Althor."
Her voice became slightly unsteady for a moment.
"Or, my Lord Dragon, if you prefer. I assure you, I harbor no ill intentions toward you. If I did, I would have struck before you knew I was here."
"You might well have died if you had." Rand's voice was icy steel. His face made it seem soft. "I'm not who has shielded you, Aes Sedai. Who are you? Why are you here? Answer me!
I don't have much patience with your kind.
Unless you want to be hauled out to the Aiel camp, I wager the wise ones can make you speak freely." This Anura was not slow-witted. Her eyes darted to Aram, then to the isle where the Ashaman stood. And she knew. They had to be who he meant in their black coats, grim faces dry when every other but hers and Rand's glistened. Young Jahar was watching her like a hawk watching a rabbit. Incongruously, Loyal stood in the midst of them with his axe propped against his shoulder. One big hand managed to hold an ink bottle and an open book, pressed awkwardly against his chest, while the other scribbled as fast as he could dip a pen fatter than Perrin's thumb. He was taking notes. Here. The nobles heard Rand as well as Anura did. They had been watching the veiled maidens uneasily. Now they crowded back from the Ashaman, pressing together like fish in a barrel. Here and there someone sagged in a faint, held up by the throng. Shivering, Anura adjusted her shawl and regained all the vaunted Aes Sedai composure.
I am Anura Larison, my lord dragon, of the Grey Alja.
Nothing about her said that she was shielded, and in the presence of men who could channel. She seemed to answer as a favor.
I am the advisor to Berylaine, first of Mayen.
So that was why Javien was grinning like a madman. He had recognized the woman. Perrin did not feel like grinning at all.
This has been kept secret, you understand, she went on, because of the attitude of Tyr both toward Mayen and toward Aes Sedai. But I think me the time for secrets. It is past, yes?
Anura turned to Kolaver, and her mouth firmed.
I let you think what you would think, but Aes Sedai do not become advisers simply because someone tells them they are. Most especially when they already advise someone else.
If Berylaine confirms your story, Rand said, I will parole you to her custody. Looking at the crown, he seemed to realize for the first time that the spray of gold and gems was still in his hand. Very gently he set it on the silk-covered seat of the Sun Throne. I don't think every Aes Sedai is my enemy. Not entirely. But I won't be schemed against, and I won't be manipulated. Not anymore. It's your choice, Anura. But if you make the wrong one, you will go to the wise ones. If you live long enough. I won't hobble the Ashaman, and a mistake could cost you.
The Ashaman, Anura said calmly. I quite understand.
But she touched her lips with her tongue.
My lord dragon, Kolaver plotted to break her oath of fealty.
Perrin had wished so hard for Fael to speak that he jumped when she did, stepping out of the line of attendants. Choosing her words carefully, she confronted the would-be queen like a stooping eagle. Light, but she was beautiful.
Kolaver swore to obey you in all things and uphold your laws, but she has made plans to rid Carrion of the Aiel, to send them south and return all to as it was before you came. She also said that if you ever returned, you would not dare change anything she had done. The woman she told these things, Mare, was one of her attendants. Mare vanished soon after telling me. I have no proof, but I believe she is dead. I believe Kolaver regretted revealing too much of her mind, too soon.
Dobrain strode up the steps to the dais, his helmet under his arm. His face might have been cold iron. Kolaver Sargon, he announced in a formal voice that carried to every corner of the Grand Hall. By my immortal soul under the light, I, Dobrain, High Seat of House Taberwin, do arraign and censure you of treason, the penalty for which is death. Rand's head went back, eyes closed. His mouth moved slightly, but Perrin knew that only he and Rand heard what was said.
No, I cannot. I will not.
Perrin understood the delay now. Rand was searching for a way out. Perrin wished he could see one. Kolaver certainly did not hear, but she wanted a way out, too. She looked around wildly, to the Sun Throne, to her other attendants, to the assembled nobility, as though they might step forward to defend her. Their feet could as well have been set in cement. A sea of carefully blank, sweaty faces confronted her, and eyes that avoided hers. Some of those eyes rolled toward the Ashaman, but not too openly. The already considerable space between nobles and Ashaman widened noticeably.
Lies!
She hissed. Hands knotted in her skirts.
All lies! You sneaking little—
She took a step toward Fael. Rand stretched his arm between them, though Kolaver appeared not to see it, and Fael looked as though she wished he had not. Anyone who attacked her was in for a surprise.
Fael does not lie, Perrin growled.
Well, not about something like this. Once again Kolaver recovered herself. Slight as her height was, she drew up every inch of it. Perrin almost admired her. Except for Mylan and Marengil and this mare, and the light alone knew how many others.
I demand justice, my lord dragon.
Her voice was calm, stately, royal.
There is no proof of any of this filth. A claim that someone who is no longer in Kyrian says I spoke words I never did? I demand the Lord Dragon's justice. By your own laws, there must be proof.
How do you know she is no longer in Kyrian? Dobraine demanded. Where is she?
I assume she is gone.
She addressed her answer to Rand.
Mare left my service, and I replaced her with Rila there.
She gestured toward the third attendant on the left.
I have no idea where she is. Bring her forward if she is in the city, and let her make these ridiculous charges to my face. I will fling her lies in her face.
Fael looked murder at her. Perrin hoped she would not produce one of those knives she kept hidden about her. She had a habit of doing that when she became angry enough. Anura cleared her throat. She had been studying Rand much too closely for Perrin's comfort. She reminded him of Varen suddenly, that look of a bird examining a worm.
May I speak, Master... my Lord Dragon?
At his curt nod, she went on, adjusting her shawl.
Of young Mare, I know nothing except that one morning she was here, and before nightfall she was nowhere to be found, and none knew where she had gone. But Lord Maringill and High Lord Mylan, they are a different matter. The first of Mayen, she brought with her two most excellent thief-catchers, men experienced in ferreting out crimes. They have brought before me two of the men who waylaid the High Lord Mylan in the streets, though both insist they only held his arms while others did the stabbing. Also they brought me the servant who put poison in the spiced wine Lord Maringill liked to drink at bedtime. She also protests her true innocence. Her invalid mother would have died, and she herself had Lord Maringill not. So she says, and in her case, I believe she speaks truly. Her solace at confession was not false, I think. Both the men and the woman agree in this. The orders for their actions came from the mouth of Lady Colivere herself.
Word by word, the defiance leached out of Colivere. She still stood, yet it seemed to wonder. She appeared as limp as a damp rag.
They promised,
she mumbled to Rand.
They promised you would never return.
Too late, she clamped both her hands over her mouth. Her eyes bulged. Perrin wished he could not hear the words coming from her throat. No one should make sounds like that.
Treason and murder,
Dobraine sounded satisfied. Those whimpered screams did not touch him.
The penalty is the same, my Lord Dragon. Death. Except by your new law, it is hanging for murder.
For some reason, Rand looked at Min. She returned his gaze with profound sadness. Not for Colivere, for Rand. Perrin wondered whether a viewing was involved.
I demand the headsman,
Colivere managed in a strangled voice. Her face sagged. She had become old on the spot, and her eyes were mirrors of stark terror. But with nothing left, she fought on for the scraps.
It is my right. I will not be hanged like some commoner.
Rand seemed to struggle with himself, shaking his head in that disturbing way. When he spoke at last, his words were winter cold and anvil hard.
Colivere Saigon, I strip you of your titles.
He drove the words like nails.
I strip you of your lands and estates and possessions. Of everything but the dress you stand in. Do you own, did you own, a farm? A small farm.
Each sentence staggered the woman. She swayed drunkenly on her feet, soundlessly mouthing the word farm as if she had never heard it before. Anura, Fael, everyone stared at Rand in amazement or curiosity or both. Perrin, not least.
A farm?
If there had been silence in the Grand Hall before, now it seemed that no one even breathed.
Dobrain, did she own a small farm?
She owned many farms, my lord dragon,
the Carrion replied slowly. Clearly he understood no more than Perrin did.
Most are large, but the lands near the dragon wall have always been divided into small holdings, less than 50 hides. All of the tenants abandoned them during the Aiel War.
Rand nodded.
Time to change that. Too much land has lain fallow too long. I want to move people back there to farm again. Dobrain, you will find out which farm of those Kolaver owned near the Dragon Wall is the smallest. Kolaver, I exile you to that farm. Dobrain will see you're provided with what is needed to make a farm work, and with someone to teach you how to till the soil.
At the dais, head dangling. Slowly, her unconscious form rose, swung around, and settled gently in front of the sun throne. Rand. Perrin was sure the Ashaman would have let her fall. Anura tisked. She did not appear surprised or perturbed, except that her thumbs rubbed her forefingers nervously.
I suspect she would have preferred the headsman. I will see to her if you have your man, your Ashaman.
She's not your concern, Rand said roughly. She is alive, and she is alive.
He drew a long, ragged breath. Min was there before he let it out. She only stood near him, yet she looked as if she wanted to do something more. Slowly his face firmed.
Anura, you will take me to Berlane. Release her, Jahar. She'll be no trouble. Not with one of her and nine of us. I want to find out what has been going on while I was away, Anura, and what Berlane means bringing you here behind my back.
No, don't speak. I'll hear it from her.
Perrin, I know you want some time with Fael.
Rand's gaze swept slowly around the hall, over all the nobles waiting silently. Under his stare, none dared move a muscle. The scent of fear far outweighed any other, convulsing sharply. Except for the hunters, everyone there had given him the same oath as had Kolaver. Perhaps just being in this gathering was treason, too? Perrin did not know.
This audience is at an end, Rand said. I will forget every face that departs now.
Those at the front, the highest ranking, the most powerful, began their progress toward the doors without too much haste, avoiding the maidens and the Ashaman standing in the aisle, while the rest waited their turn. Every mind must have been turning over what Rand had said, though. What precisely did he mean by now? Purposeful strides quickened, skirts were lifted. Hunters, nearest the doors, began slipping out, first one at a time, then in a flood, and seeing them, lesser nobles among the Carrionan and Tyrans departed ahead of the higher. In moments it was a milling mass at the doors, men and women pushing and elbowing to get out. Not one looked back at the woman stretched out before the throne she had held so briefly. Chapter 6 Old Fear and New Fear. Rand passed through the struggling mob without any difficulty, of course. Maybe it was the presence of the maidens and the Ashaman, or maybe Rand or one of the black-coated fellows did something with the power, but the crowd parted for him, with Min holding to his arm, and a very subdued Anura attempting to speak to him, and Loyal, who was still trying with some difficulty to write in his book, and carry his axe. Staring at one another, Perrin and Fael missed their chance to join them before the crowd closed up again. She said nothing for a time, and neither did he, not what he wanted to say, not with Aram there, staring at them like some worshipful hound. And Dobrain, frowning down at the unconscious woman put in his charge. No one else remained on the dais. Havian had gone with Rand to find Berlane, and as soon as Rand went, the other attendants had darted away toward the doors without a second glance at Perrin or Fael, or Kolaver. Without the first glance, for that matter. They just lifted their striped skirts and ran. Grunts and curses drifted from the pack, not all in men's voices. Even with Rand gone, those people wanted to be elsewhere, and now. Perhaps they thought Perrin stayed to watch and report, though had any glanced back, they would have seen his eyes were not on them. Climbing the rest of the way, he took Fael's hand and breathed in the scent of her. This close, the lingering perfumes did not matter. Anything else could wait. She produced a red lace fan from somewhere, and before spreading it to cool herself, touched first her cheek, then his. There was a whole language of fans in her native Saldaea. She had taught him a little. He wished he knew what the cheek-touching meant. It must be something good. On the other hand, her scent carried a spiky shading he knew too well. "He should have sent her to the block," Dobrain muttered, and Perrin shrugged uncomfortably. From the man's tone, it was not clear whether he meant that that was what the law called for, or that it would have been more merciful. Dobrain did not understand. Rand could have sprouted wings first. Fael's fan slowed to barely moving, and she eyed Dobrain sideways over the crimson lace.
"Her death might be best for everyone. That is the prescribed penalty. What will you do, Lord Dobrain?"
Sidelong or not, it still managed to be very direct, a very meaningful gaze. Perrin frowned. Not a word for him, but questions for Dobrain. And there was that undertone of jealousy in her aroma, making him sigh. The Carianan gave her a level look in a return, while thrusting his gauntlets behind his sword belt.
"What I was commanded to do. I keep my oaths, Lady Fael."
The fan snapped open and shut, faster than thought.
"He actually sent Aes Sedai to the Aiel? As prisoners?"
Disbelief tinged her voice.
"Some, Lady Fael," Dobrain hesitated.
"Some swore fealty on their knees. This I saw with my own eyes. They went to the Aiel too, but I do not think they can be called prisoners."
"I saw it too, my lady,"
Aram put in from his place on the steps, and a wide smile split his face when she glanced at him. Red lace described a fluttering hitch. What she did with the fan seemed almost unconscious.
"You both saw."
The relief in her voice and in her scent was so strong that Perrin stared.
"What did you think, Fael? Would Rand lie, especially when everyone would know in a day?"
Instead of answering immediately, she frowned down at Kolivar.
"Is she still under? Not that it matters, I suppose. She knows more than I would say here. Everything we worked so hard to keep hidden. She let that slip to Mare, too. She knows too much."
Dobrain thumbed one of Kolivar's eyes open none too gently.
"As if hit with a mace. A pity she did not break her neck on the steps. But she will go to her exile and learn to live as a farmer."
A brief, jaggedy, vexed smell wafted from Fael. Abruptly it hit Perrin what his wife had been proposing so obliquely, what Dobrain had rejected just as indirectly. Every hair in his body tried to stand. From the start he had known that he had married a very dangerous woman, just not how dangerous. Aram was peering at Kolivar, his lips pursed in dark thought. The man would do anything for Fael.
"I don't think Rand would like it if anything prevented her reaching that farm,"
Perrin said firmly, eyeing Aram and Fael in turn.
"I wouldn't like it either."
He felt rather proud of himself. That was talking around the point as well as any of them. Aram bowed his head briefly. He understood, but Fael tried to look innocent above her gently fluttering fan, with no notion what he was talking about. Suddenly he realized not all the fear scent came from the people still milling at the door. A thin, quivering thread of it wafted from her. Fear under control, yet it was there.
"What's the matter, Fael? Light you'd think Coiran and that lot had won instead of—"
Her face did not change, but the thread grew thicker.
"Is that why you didn't say anything at first?" he asked softly. "Were you afraid we had come back as puppets, and them pulling the strings?"
She eyed the rapidly diminishing crowd across the grand hall. The nearest of them was a long way, and all making a good deal of noise, but she lowered her voice even so.
Aes Sedai can do that sort of thing, I've heard. My husband, no one knows more than I that even Aes Sedai would find hard times trying to make you dance for a puppet. Much harder than a man who's just the dragon reborn. But when you walked in here, I was more afraid than at any time since you left.
Amusement trickled through in the first of that, like tiny bubbles in his nose, and warm fondness, and love, the smell of her clear and pure and strong. But all of those faded by the end, leaving that thin trembling thread.
Lightfael, it's true!
Lightfael, it's true. Every word Rand said. You heard Dobrain and Aram? She smiled and nodded and worked her fan. That thread still quivered in his nostrils, though.
Blood and ashes, what does it take to convince her?
Would it help if he had Varen dance the Sassara? She will, if he tells her to. He meant it for a joke. All he knew of the Sassara was that it was scandalous, and that Fael had once admitted knowing how to dance it, though recently she sidestepped and all but denied it. He meant it for a joke, but she closed her fan and tapped it on her wrist. He knew that one. I am giving your suggestion serious thought. I don't know what would be enough, Perrin. She shivered slightly. Is there anything an Aes Sedai would not do or put up with if the White Tower told her to? I have studied my history, and I was taught to read between the lines. Mashera Danavel bore 7 children for a man she loathed, whatever the stories say. And Isabai Tobanyi delivered the brothers she loved to their enemies and the throne of Arad-Daman with them. And Jestion Redhill? She shivered again, not so slightly. It's all right, he murmured, wrapping her in his arms. He had studied several books of history himself, but he had never seen those names. The daughter of a lord received a different education from a blacksmith's apprentice. It really is true. Dobrain averted his eyes, and so did Aram, though with a pleased grin. She resisted at first, but not very hard. He could never be sure when she would avoid a public embrace, and when welcome it. Only that if she did not want one, she made it clear in no uncertain terms, with or without words. This time she snuggled her face into his chest and hugged him back, squeezing harder.
If any Aes Sedai ever harms you, she whispered, I will kill her.
He believed her.
You belong to me, Perrin Tabashir Ebara. To me.
He believed that, too. As her hug grew fiercer, so did the thorny scent of jealousy. He almost chuckled. It seemed the right to put a knife in him was reserved to her. He would have chuckled, except that filament of fear remained. That and what she had said about Mare. He could not smell himself, but he knew what was there. Fear. Old fear, and new fear, for the next time. The last of the nobles forced their way from the Grand Hall without anyone being trampled. Sending Aram off to tell Danil to bring the Two Rivers men into the city, and wondering how he was going to feed them, Perrin offered Fael his arm and led her out, leaving Dobrain with Kolaver, who was finally showing signs of awakening. He had no wish to be around when she woke, and Fael, with her hand on his wrist, seemed not to either. They walked quickly, eager to reach their rooms, if not necessarily for the same reasons. The nobles apparently had not stopped their flight once they were out of the Grand Hall. The corridors were empty, except for servants who kept their eyes down and moved at a silent rush. But before they had gone very far, Perrin caught the sound of footsteps and realized they were being followed. It seemed unlikely that Kolaver had any open supporters still, but if there were any, they might think to strike at Rand through his friend, walking alone with his wife while the Dragon Reborn was elsewhere. Only when Perrin spun about, hand to his axe, he stared instead of drawing the weapon. It was Salanda and her friends from the entry hall, with 8 or 9 new faces. They gave a start when he turned, and exchanged abashed glances. Some were Tyrans, including a woman who stood taller than all but one of the Carrionan men. She wore a man's coat and tight breeches, just like Solanda and the rest of the women, with a sword on her hip. He had not heard that this nonsense had spread to the Tyrans.
"Why are you following us?" he demanded. "If you try to make me any of your woolhead trouble, I vow I'll kick the lot of you from here to Beltane."
He had had problems before with these idiots, or some just like them anyway. All they thought about was their honor and fighting duels, and taking one another Gaishine. That last really set the Aiel's teeth on edge.
"Attend my husband and obey," Fahil put in sharply. "He is not a man to be trifled with."
Gawking stares vanished, and they backed away, bowing, competing over flourishes. They were still at it when they vanished around a turn.
"Bloody young buffoons," Perrin muttered, offering Fahil his wrist again.
"My husband is wise in his years," she murmured. Her tone was utterly serious. Her smell was something else again.
Perrin managed not to snort. True, a few of them might be a year or two older than he, but they were all like children with their playing at Aiel. Now, with Fahil in a good mood, seemed as good a time as any to begin what they had to talk about, what he had to talk about.
"Fahil, how did you come to be one of Kolaver's attendants?"
"The servants, Perrin,"
she spoke softly. Nobody two steps away could have heard a word. She knew all about his hearing and the wolves. That was nothing a man could keep from his wife. Her fan touched her ear, admonishing caution in speech.
"Too many people forget servants are there, but servants listen too. In Carrion, they listen far too much."
None of the liveried people he saw were doing any listening. The few who did not duck down side corridors when they saw him and Fahil went by at a near run, gazes on the floor, and gathered in on themselves. Any sort of news spread quickly in Carrion. Events in the Grand Hall would have flown. The word was in the streets by now, probably on its way out of the city already. Without any doubt, there were eyes and ears in Carrion for the Aes Sedai and the White Cloaks, and likely more thrones than not. In that hushed voice, she went on despite her caution to him.
"Kolaver could not be fast enough to take me in, once she learned who I am. My father's name impressed her as much as my cousin's."
She finished with a little nod, as if she had answered everything. It was a good answer. Almost. Her father was Davram, High Seat of House Bashir, Lord of Bashir, Tyre, and Sedona, Guardian of the Blight Border, Defender of the Heartland, and Marshal General to Queen Tenobia of Saldaea. Fahil's cousin was Tenobia herself. More than reason for Kolaver to leap at Fahil for one of her attendants. But he had had time to mull things over now, and he prided himself that he was becoming used to her ways. Married life taught a man about women, or about one woman anyway. The answer she had not given confirmed something. Fahil had no concept of danger, not where she herself was concerned. He could not speak of it there in the corridor, of course. Whisper how he would, she did not have his ears, and doubtless she would insist every servant within 50 paces was listening. Holding his patience, he walked on with her until they reached the rooms that had been set aside for them, what seemed an age ago now. The lamps had been lit, making shimmers on the dark polished walls, each tall wooden panel carved in concentric rectangles. In the square stone fireplace, the hearth was swept bare and laid with a few pitiful branches of leather leaf. They were almost green. Fahil went straight to a small table where two golden pitchers stood beaded with moisture on a tray.
"They have left us blueberry tea, my husband, and wine punch. The wine is from Theron, I think. They cool the punch in the cisterns beneath the palace. Which would you prefer?"
Theron unbuckled his belt and tossed belt and axe on a chair. He had planned out what he had to say very carefully on the way here. She could be a prickly woman.
"Fahil, I missed you more than I can say, and worried about you, but..."
"Worried about me?"
she snapped, spinning to face him. She stood straight and tall, eyes fierce as those of her falcon namesake, and her fan made a cawing motion toward his middle. No part of the language of fans. She made the same gesture with a knife sometimes.
When almost the first words from your mouth were to ask after that... that woman...
His jaw dropped. How could he have forgotten the smell filling his nostrils? He nearly put a hand up to see whether his nose was bleeding.
Bael, I wanted her thief catchers.
No, he was not stupid enough to repeat that name.
She said she had proof of the poison before I left. You heard her. I just wanted the proof, Fael.
It did no good. That spiky stench softened not a whit, and the thin, sour smell of hurt joined it. What under the light had he said to hurt her?
Her proof! What I gathered went for nothing, but her proof put Colivert's head on the block, or should have.
That was his opening, but she was not about to let him push a word in edgewise. She advanced on him, looking daggers, her fan darting like one. All he could do was back away.
Do you know what story that woman put about?
Fayil almost hissed. A black viper could not have dripped so much venom.
Do you? She said the reason you were not here was that you were at a manor not far from the city, where she could visit you. I told the story I prepared, that you were hunting, and the light knows you spent enough days hunting, but everyone believed I was putting a good face on you and her. Together! Colivert delighted in it. I could believe she only took that Mayenner strumpet as an attendant to throw the two of us together. Fayil, Berylaine, come lace my gown. Fayil, Berylaine, come hold the mirror for the hairdresser. Fayil, Berylaine, come wash my back. So she could amuse herself, waiting for us to claw one another's eyes out. That is what I've had to put up with. For you, you hairy-eared...
His back thumped against the wall, and something snapped inside him. He had been frightened spitless for her, terrified, ready to face down Rand or the Dark One himself. And he had done nothing, had never encouraged Berylaine, had done everything in his wits to chase the woman away. For which his thanks was this. Gently he took her by the shoulders and lifted her until those big tilted eyes were level with his.
"You listen to me," he said calmly.
He tried to make his voice calm, at least. It came out more of a growl in his throat.
"How dare you speak to me like that? How dare you? I worried myself near to death for fear you'd been hurt. I love you, and nobody else but you. I want no other woman but you. Do you hear me? Do you?"
Crushing her to his chest, he held her, wanting to never let her go. Light, he had been so afraid. He shook even now for what might have been.
"If anything happened to you, I'd die for you. I would lie down on your grave and die. Do you think I don't know how Colivert found out who you are? You made sure she found out."
Spying, she had told him once, was a wife's work.
"Light woman, you could have ended like Mare. Colivert knows you're my wife. My wife. Perrin Ebarra. Randall Thor's friend. Did it ever occur to you she might be suspicious? She could have... Light Fayil, she could have..."
Abruptly, he realized what he was doing. She was making sounds against his chest, but no words he could recognize. He wondered that he did not hear her ribs creaking. Berating himself for an oaf, he let her go, arms springing apart, but before he could apologize, her fingers clutched his beard.
"So you love me," she said softly.
Very softly. Very warmly. She was smiling, too.
A woman likes to hear that said the right way.
She had dropped the fan, and her free hand drew fingernails down his cheek, not far from hard enough to draw blood. But her throaty laugh held heat, and the smoldering in her eyes was as far from anger as possible.
"A good thing you didn't say you never looked at another woman, or I would think you had gone blind."
He was too stunned for words, too stunned even to gape. Rand understood women. Matt understood women. But Perrin knew he never would. She was always as much Kingfisher as Falcon, changing direction faster than he could think. Yet this... That thorny scent was gone completely, and in its place was another smell of her he knew well. A smell that was her, pure and strong and clean. Add that to her eyes, and any moment she was going to say something about farm girls at harvest. They were notorious, apparently, Saldaean farm girls. "As for you lying down on my grave," she went on, "if you do, my soul will haunt yours, I promise you. You will mourn me a decent time, and then you'll find yourself another wife. Someone I'd approve of, I hope." With a soft laugh, she stroked his beard. "You really aren't fit to take care of yourself, you know. I want your promise." Best not to crack his teeth on that. Say he would not, and this wonderful mood might be swallowed in a firestorm. Quicksilver was not in it, really. Say he would... By the smell of her, every word was the light's pure truth, but he would believe that when horses roosted in trees. He cleared his throat. "I need to bathe. I haven't seen soap in I don't know how long. I must smell like an old barn." Leaning against his chest, she drew a deep breath. "You smell wonderful. Like you." Her hands moved on his shoulders. "I feel as..." The door banged open.
"Perrin! Berylaine isn't..."
"I'm sorry. Forgive me." Rand stood shifting his feet, not at all like the dragon reborn. There were maidens in the hallway outside. Min put her head around the doorframe, took one look, grinned at Perrin, and ducked back out of sight. Fael stepped away so smoothly, so stately, that one would never have guessed what she had been saying a moment before. Or what she had been about to say. There were spots of color in her cheeks, though, bright and hot.
"So kind of you, my lord dragon," she said coolly, "to drop in so unexpectedly. I apologize for not hearing your knock."
Maybe those blushes were as much anger as embarrassment. It was Rand's turn to blush and scrub a hand through his hair.
"Berylaine isn't in the palace. She's spending the night on that sea folk ship anchored in the river, of all things. Anura didn't tell me till I was nearly to Berylaine's apartments."
Perrin tried very hard not to wince. Why did he have to keep saying the woman's name?
"You wanted to talk to me about something else, Rand?"
He hoped he had not put too much emphasis in that, yet he hoped Rand caught it. He did not look at Fael, but he tested the air gingerly. No jealousy, not yet. A good deal of anger, however. For a moment, Rand stared at him, looked through him, listening to something else. Perrin folded his arms to stop from shuddering. "I need to know," Rand said finally. "Are you still unwilling to command the army against Ilion? I have to know now."
"I'm no general," Perrin said raggedly.
There would be battles in Ilion. Images flashed in his head. Men all around him, and the axe in his hands spinning, hewing his way through. Always more men, however many he cut down, in endless ranks. And in his heart, a seed growing. He could not face that again. He would not. "Besides, I thought I was supposed to stay close to you." That was what Min had said, from one of her viewings. Twice Perrin had to be there, or Rand would go down to disaster. Once had been Dumais Wells, maybe, but there was still another to come. "We must all take risks." Rand's voice was very quiet and very hard. Min peered around the doorframe again, looking as if she wanted to come to him, but she glanced at Fael and stayed outside.
"Rand, the Aes Sedai..."
A smart man would let this lie, probably. He had never claimed to be particularly smart, though. "The wise ones are ready to skin them alive, or near enough. You can't let them be harmed, Rand." In the corridor, Sulin turned to study him through the doorway. The man he thought he knew laughed, a wheezing sound.
"We all have to take risks," he repeated. "I won't let them be hurt, Rand."
Cold blue eyes met his gaze.
"You won't let it?"
"I won't,"
Perrin told him levelly. He did not flinch from that stare, either.
"They are prisoners and no threat. They're women."
"They are Aes Sedai." Rand's voice was so like Aram's back at Demise Wells that it nearly took Perrin's breath away.
"Rand, I do what I have to do, Perrin."
For a moment he was the old Rand, not liking what was happening. For a moment he looked tired to death. A moment only. Then he was the new Rand again, hard enough to mark steel. "I won't harm any Aes Sedai who doesn't deserve it, Perrin. I can't promise more. Since you don't want the army, I can use you elsewhere. Just as well, really. I wish I could let you rest longer than a day or two, but I can't. There's no time. No time, and we must do what we must. Forgive me for interrupting you." He sketched a bow, one hand on the hilt of his sword.
"Fail."
Perrin tried to catch his arm, but he was out of the room, the door closing behind him, before Perrin could move. Rand was not really Rand anymore, it seemed. A day or two? Where in the light did Rand mean him to go, if not to the army gathering down on the plains of Moredo?
"My husband," Fael breathed, "you have the courage of three men, and the sense of a child on leading strings. Why is it that as a man's courage goes up, his sense goes down?"
Perrin grunted indignantly. He refrained from mentioning women who set themselves to spy on people who had committed murders and almost certainly knew they were spying. Women always talked about how logical they were compared to men, but for himself, he had seen precious little of it.
"Well, perhaps I don't really want the answer, even if you know it."
Stretching with her arms over her head, she gave a throaty laugh.
"Besides, I don't mean to let him spoil the mood. I still feel as forward as a farm girl at—" "Why are you laughing? Stop laughing at me, Perrin Tabashir Ibarra! Stop it, I say, you uncouth oaf! If you don't—"
The only way to put an end to it was to kiss her. In her arms, he forgot Rand and Aes Sedai and battles. Where Fael was home. Chapter 7. Pitfalls and Tripwires. Rand felt the dragon scepter in his hand, felt every line of the carved dragons against his heron-branded palm, as clearly as if he were running his fingers over them. Yet it seemed someone else's hand. If a blade cut it off, he would feel the pain and keep going. It would be another's pain. He floated in the void, surrounded by emptiness beyond knowing, and Saidin filled him, trying to grind him to dust beneath steel-shattering cold and heat where stone would flash to flame, carrying the Dark One's taint on its flow, forcing corruption into his bones. Into his soul, he feared sometimes. It did not make him feel so sick to his stomach as it once had. He feared that even more. And larded through that torrent of fire, ice, and filth, life. That was the best word. Saidin tried to destroy him. Saidin filled him to overflowing with vitality. It threatened to bury him, and it enticed him. The war for survival, the struggle to avoid being consumed, magnified the joy of pure life. So sweet even with the foulness. What would it be like clean? Beyond imagining. He wanted to draw more, draw all there was. There lay the deadly seduction. One slip and the ability to channel would be seared out of him forever. One slip and his mind was gone, if he was not simply destroyed on the spot, and maybe everything around him too. It was not madness, focusing on the fight for existence. It was like high-walking blindfolded over a pit full of sharpened stakes, basking in so pure a sense of life that thinking of giving it up was like thinking of a world forever in shades of gray. Not madness. His thoughts whirled through his dance with Sidene, slid across the void. Anura, peering at him with that Aes Sedai gaze. What was Berylaine playing at? She had never mentioned an Aes Sedai advisor, and those other Aes Sedai in Kyrian. Where had they come from, and why? The rebels outside the city. What had emboldened them to move? What did they intend now? How could he stop them or use them? He was becoming good at using people. Sometimes he made himself sick. Sivana and the Shido? Ruark already had scouts on the way to Kinslayer's Dagger, but at best they could only find out where and when. The wise ones who could find out why would not. There were a lot of whys connected to Sivana. Elaine and Avienda. No, he would not think of them. No thoughts of them. None. Perrin and Fael. A fierce woman, Falcon by name and nature. Had she really attached herself to Kolaver just to gather evidence? She would try to protect Perrin if the Dragon Reborn fell. Protect him from the Dragon Reborn, should she decide it necessary. Her loyalties were to Perrin, but she would decide for herself how to meet them. Fael was no woman to do meekly as her husband told her, if such a woman existed. Golden eyes, staring challenge and defiance. Why was Perrin so vehement about the Aes Sedai? He had been a long time with Karuna and her companions on the road to Dumai's Wells. Could Aes Sedai really do with him what everybody feared? Aes Sedai. He shook his head without being aware. Never again. Never. To trust was to be betrayed. Trust was pain. He tried to push that thought away. It came a little too close to raving. Nobody could live without giving trust somewhere. Not just to Aes Sedai. Matt. Perrin. If he could not trust them... Min? Never a thought of not trusting Min. He wished she were with him instead of snugged in her bed. All those days of prisoner, days of worry, more for him than herself if he knew her, days of being questioned by Galena and ill-treated when her answers failed to please. Unconsciously he ground his teeth. All of that, and the strain of being healed on top of it, had caught up with her at last. She had stayed by his side until her legs gave way, and he had to carry her to her bedchamber, with her sleepily protesting all the way that he needed her with him. No Min here. No comforting presence to make him laugh, make him forget the Dragon Reborn. Only the war with Sidene, and the whirlwind of his thoughts, and... They must be done away with. You must do it. Don't you remember the last time... That place by the wells was a pittance. Cities burned whole out of the earth were nothing. We destroyed the world. Do you hear me? They have to be killed. Wiped from the face. Not his, that voice shouting inside his skull. Not Randall Thor. Lose Theron Telamon, more than 3,000 years dead. And talking in Randall Thor's head. The power often drew him out of his hiding place in the shadows of Rand's mind. Sometimes Rand wondered how that could be. He was Luz Theron reborn, the dragon reborn, no denying that. But everybody was someone reborn, 100 someones, 1,000, more. That was how the pattern worked. Everyone died and was reborn again and again as the wheel turned, forever without end. But nobody else talked with who they used to be. Nobody else had voices in their heads. Except madmen. What about me? Rand thought. One hand tightened on the dragon scepter, the other on his sword hilt. What about you? How are we different from them? There was only silence. Often enough, Luz Theron did not answer. Maybe it had been better when he never had. Are you real? The voice said at last, wonderingly. That denial of Rand's existence was as usual as refusing to answer.
Am I? I spoke to someone. I think I did. Inside a box. A chest.
Wheezing laughter, soft.
Am I dead or mad or both? No matter. I am surely damned. I am damned, and this is the pit of doom. I am damned.
Wild, that laughing now.
And this is the pit of...
Rand muted the voice to an insect's buzz, something he had learned while cramped into that chest. Alone, in the dark. Just him and the pain and the thirst and the voice of a long-dead madman. The voice had been a comfort sometimes, his only companion, his friend. Something flashed in his mind. Not images, just flickers of color and motion. For some reason, they made him think of Matt and Perrin. The flashes had begun inside the chest, them and a thousand more hallucinations. In the chest, where Galena and Arian and Catherine and the rest stuffed him every day after he was beaten. He shook his head. No. He was not in the chest anymore. His fingers ached, clenched around scepter and hilt. Only memories remained, and memories had no force. He was not. If we must make this journey before you eat, let us make it. The evening meal is long finished for everyone else. Rand blinked, and Sulin stepped back from his stare. Sulin, who would stand eye to eye with a leopard. He smoothed his face, tried to. It felt a mask, somebody else's face.
Are you well? She asked.
I was thinking. He made his hands unknot, shrugged inside his coat. A better-fitting coat than the one he had worn from Dumai's Wells, dark blue and plain. Even after a bath he did not feel clean, not with cyanide in him. Sometimes I think too much. Nearly 20 more maidens clustered at one end of the windowless, dark-paneled room. 8 gilded stand lamps against the walls, mirrored to increase the light, provided illumination. He was glad of that. He did not like dark places anymore. 3 of the Ashaman were there, too. The Aiel women to one side of the chamber, and the Ashaman to the other. Jonan Adley and Altaren, despite his name, stood with his arms folded, working eyebrows like black caterpillars in deep thought. Perhaps 4 years older than Rand, he was intent on earning the silver sword of the dedicated. Eben Hopwill carried more flesh on his bones and fewer blotches on his face than when Rand had first seen him, though his nose and ears still seemed the biggest part of him. He fingered the sword pin on his collar as if surprised to find it there. Fedwin Moore would have worn the sword as well, had he not been in a green coat suitable for a well-to-do merchant or a minor noble, with a little silver embroidery on cuffs and lapels. Of an age with Eben, but stockier, and with almost no blotches, he did not look happy that his black coat was stuffed into the leather scrip by his feet. They were the ones Luce Theron had been raving about, them and all the rest of the Ashaman. Ashaman, Aes Sedai. Anyone who could channel set him off, often as not.
Think too much, Randall Thor?
Enyla gripped a short spear in one hand and her buckler and 3 more spears in the other, yet she sounded as if she were shaking a finger at him. The Ashaman frowned at her.
Your trouble is you do not think at all.
Some of the other maidens laughed softly, but she was not making a joke. Shorter than any other maiden there, by at least a hand, she had hair as fiery as her temper, and an odd view of her relationship to him. Her flaxen-haired friend Somara, who stood head and shoulders taller, nodded agreement. She held the same peculiar view. He ignored the comment, but could not stop a sigh. Somara and Enyla were the worst, yet none of the maidens could decide whether he was the Kara Karn, to be obeyed, or the only child of a maiden ever known to the maidens, to be cared for as a brother, bullied as a son for a few. Even Jelani there, not many years from playing with dolls, seemed to think he was her younger brother, while Corona, graying and nearly as leather-faced as Sulin, treated him like an older. At least they only did that around themselves, not often where other Aiel could hear. When it counted, he would be the Karakarn. And he owed it to them. They died for him. He owed them whatever they wanted. "I don't intend to spend all night here while you lot play Kiss the Daisies," he said. Sulin gave him one of those looks. In dresses or in cotton sore, women tossed those looks about like farmers scattering seed. But the Ashaman abandoned staring at the maidens and slung the straps of their scripts over their shoulders. "Push them hard," he had told Taim. "Make them weapons," and Taim had delivered. A good weapon moved as the man who held it directed. If only he could be sure it would not turn in his hand. He had three destinations tonight, but one of those the maidens could not be allowed to know. No one but himself. Which of the other two came first, he had decided earlier, yet he hesitated. The journey would be known soon enough, yet there were reasons to keep it secret as he could. When the gateway opened there in the middle of the room, a sweetish smell, familiar to any farmer, drifted through. Horse dung. Wrinkling her nose as she veiled, Sulin led half the maidens through at a trot. After a glance to him, the Ashaman followed, drawing deeply on the true source as they went, as much as they could hold. Because of that, he could feel their strength as they passed him. Without that, it took some effort to tell a man could channel. Longer still, unless he cooperated. None were near as strong as he. Not yet, anyway. There was no saying how strong a man would be until he stopped growing stronger. Fedwin stood highest of the three, but he had what Taim called a bar. Fedwin did not really believe he could affect anything at a distance with the power. The result was that at 50 paces, his ability began to fade, and at 100, he could not weave even a thread of Saidin. Men gained strength faster than women, it seemed, and a good thing. These three were all strong enough to make a gateway of useful size, if just barely in Jonan's case. Every Ashaman was, that he had kept.
"Kill them before it is too late, before they go mad," Luthern whispered. "Kill them. Hunt down Samael and Dimandred, and all the Forsaken. I have to kill them all before it is too late."
A moment of struggle as he attempted to wrest the power away from Rand and failed. He seemed to try that more often of late, or to seize Saidin on his own. The second was a bigger danger than the first. Rand doubted that Luthern could take the true source away once Rand held it. He was not certain he could take it from Luthern either, if the other reached it first.
"What about me?" Rand thought again.
It was nearly a snarl, and no less vicious for falling short. Wrapped in the power as he was, anger spiderwebbed across the outside of the void, a fiery lace.
"I can channel too. Madness awaits for me, but it already has you. You killed yourself, Kinslayer, after you murdered your wife and your children, and the light alone knows how many others. I won't kill where I don't have to. Do you hear me, Kinslayer?"
Silence answered. He drew a deep, uneven breath. That web of fire flickered, lightning in the distance. He had never spoken to the man. It was the man, not just a voice, a man, entire with memories. Never spoken to him like that before. Perhaps it might drive Luthern away for good. Half the man's mad rantings were tears over his dead wife. Did he want to drive Luthern away? His only friend in that chest? He had promised Sulin to count to 100 before following, but he did it by fives, then stepped more than 150 leagues to Camelin. Night had closed down on the royal palace of Andor, moonshadows cloaking delicate spires in golden domes, but a gentle breeze did nothing to break the heat. The moon hung above, still almost full, giving some light. Veiled maidens scurried around the wagons lined up behind the largest of the palace stables. The odor of the stable muck the wagons hauled away every day had long since soaked into the wood. The Ashaman had hands to their faces, Eben actually pinching his nose shut.
"The Karakarn counts quickly," Sulin muttered, but she lowered her veil.
There would be no surprises here. No one would stay near those wagons who did not have to.
Rand let the gateway close as soon as the remaining maidens came through, right behind him. And as it winked out of existence, Luz Theron whispered,
"She's gone. Almost gone."
There was relief in his voice. The bond of Warder and Aes Sedai had not existed in the Age of Legends. Alana was not really gone, no more than she had been any time since bonding Rand against his will. But her presence had lessened, and it was the lessening that made Rand truly aware. You could become used to anything, begin taking it for granted. Near to her, he walked around with her emotions nestled in the back of his head, her physical condition as well, if he thought about it. And he knew exactly where she was as well as he knew his own hand's place. But just as with his hand, unless he thought about it, it just was. Only distance had any effect, but he could still feel that she was somewhere east of him. He wanted to be aware of her. Should Luz Theron fall silent and all the memories of the chest somehow be wiped from his head, he would still have the bond to remind him, never trust Aes Sedai. Abruptly, he realized that Jonan and Eben still held Saidin too.
"Release!"
he said sharply. That was the command Taim used, and he felt the power vanish from them. Good weapons. So far.
"Kill them before it's too late,"
Luz Theron murmured. Rand released the source deliberately and reluctantly. He always hated letting go of the life, the enhanced senses, of the struggle. Inside, though, he was tense, a jumper ready to leap, ready to seize it once more. He always was, now.
"I have to kill them," Luz Theron whispered.
Shoving the voice back, Rand sent one of the maidens, Neralia, a square-faced woman, into the palace, and began pacing alongside the wagons, thoughts spinning again, faster than before. He should not have come here. He should have sent Fedwin with a letter. Spinning. Elaine, Avienda, Perrin, Fael, Anura, Berylaine, Matt.
Lighty should not have come.
Elaine and Avienda, Anura and Berylaine, Fael and Perrin and Matt. Flashes of color, quick motion just out of sight. A madman muttering angrily in the distance. Slowly he became aware of the maidens talking among themselves. About the smell, implying that it came from the Ashaman. They wanted to be heard, or they would have been using hand talk. There was moonlight enough for that. Moonlight enough to see the color in Eben's face, too, and how Fedwin's jaw was set. Maybe they were not boys any longer, not since Dumai's Wells, certainly. But they were still only 15 or 16. Jonan's eyebrows had drawn down so far they seemed to be sitting on his cheeks. At least nobody had seized Saidin again. Yet. He started to step over to the three men, then raised his voice instead. Let them all hear. "If I can put up with foolishness from maidens, so can you." If anything, the color in Eben's face deepened. Jonan grunted. All three saluted Rand with fist to chest. Then they turned to one another. Jonan said something in a low voice, glancing at the maidens, and Fedwin and Eben laughed. The first time they saw maidens, they had stumbled between wanting to goggle at these exotic creatures they had only read about, and wanting to run before the murderous Aiel of the stories killed them. Nothing much frightened them anymore. They needed to relearn fear. The maidens stared at Rand and began talking with their hands, sometimes laughing softly. Wary of the Ashaman they might be, yet maidens being maidens, Aiel being Aiel, risk only made taunts more fun. Samara murmured aloud about Avienda settling him down, which earned firm nods of approval. Nobody's life was ever this tangled in the stories. As soon as Neralia returned, saying that she had found Davram Bashir and Bale, the clan chief leading the Aiel here in Camelon, Rand took off his sword belt, and so did Fedwin. Jelani produced a large leather bag for the swords and the dragon scepter, holding it as if the swords were poisonous snakes, or perhaps long dead and rotten. Though in truth, she would not have held it so gingerly in either case. Putting on a hooded cloak that Karana handed him, Rand held his wrists together behind his back, and Sulin bound them with a cord.
tightly, muttering to herself.
This is nonsense. Even wetlanders would call it nonsense. This is nonsense. Even wetlanders would call it nonsense.
He tried not to wince. She was strong, and using every ounce of it.
You have run away from us too often, Randolph Thor. You have no care for yourself.
She considered him a brother of an age with herself, but irresponsible at times.
Fargerize my carries your honor, and you have no care.
Fedwin glowered while his own wrists were tied, though the maiden binding him hardly put out much effort. Watching, Jonan and Eben frowned deeply. They disliked this plan as much as Sulan did, and understood it as little. The dragon reborn did not have to explain himself, and the Karakarn seldom did. No one said anything, though. A weapon did not complain. When Sulan stepped around in front of Rand, she took one look at his face, and her breath caught.
"They did this to you," she said softly,
and reached for her heavy-bladed belt knife. A foot or more of steel, it was almost a short sword, though none but a fool would say that to an Aiel.
"Pull up the hood," Rand told her roughly. "The whole point of this is that no one recognized me before I reach Bale and Bashir."
She hesitated, peering into his eyes.
"I said pull it up," he growled.
Sulan could kill most men with her bare hands, but her fingers were gentle, settling the hood around his face. With a laugh, Jelani snatched the hood down over his eyes.
"Now you can be sure no one will know you, Randolph Thor. You must trust us to guide your feet."
Several maidens laughed. Stiffening, he barely stopped short of seizing Saidin. Barely. Luce Theron snarled and gibbered. Rand forced himself to breathe normally. It was not total darkness. He could see moonlight below the edge of the hood. Even so, he stumbled when Sulan and Anila took his arms and led him forward.
"I thought you were old enough to walk better than that," Anila murmured in mock surprise.
Sulan's hand moved. It took him a moment to realize she was stroking his arm. All he could see was what lay just before him, the moonlit flagstones of the stable yard, then stone steps, floors of marble by lamplight, sometimes with a long runner of carpet. He strained his eyes at the movement of shadows, felt for the telltale presence of Saidin, or worse, the prickling that announced a woman holding Saidar. Blind like this, he might not know he was under attack until too late. He could hear the whisper of a few servants' feet as they hurried on nighttime chores, but no one challenged five maidens, apparently escorting two hooded prisoners. With Bale and Bashir living in the palace and policing Camelin with their men, doubtless stranger sights had been seen in these corridors. It was like walking a maze. But then he had been in one maze or another since leaving Emmons Field, even when he had thought that he walked a clear path.
"Would I know a clear path if I saw one?" he wondered. "Or have I been at this so long I'd think it was a trap?" "There are no clear paths, only pitfalls and tripwires and darkness."
Luce Theron's snarl sounded sweaty, desperate, the way Rand felt. When Sulan finally led them into a room and shut the door, Rand tossed his head violently to throw back the hood, and stared. Bale and Davram he had expected, but not Davram's wife, Dira, nor Malayne, nor Dorinda.
"I see you, Karakarn."
Bale, the tallest man Rand had ever seen, sat cross-legged on the green and white floor tiles in his Karansor, an air about him even at ease that said he was ready to move in a heartbeat. The clan chief of the Goshin Aiel was not young, no clan chief was, and there was gray in his dark reddish hair, but anyone who thought him soft with age was in for a sad surprise.
"May you always find water and shade. I stand with the Karakarn, and my spears stand with me."
"Water and shade may all be very well," Davram Bashir said, hooking a leg over the gilded arm of his chair. "But myself, I would settle for chilled wine."
Little taller than Anila, he had his short blue coat undone, and sweat glistened on his dark face. Despite his apparent indolence, he looked even harder than Bale, with his fierce tilted eyes and his eagle's beak of a nose above thick gray-streaked mustaches.
I offer congratulations on your escape and your victory. But why do you come disguised as a prisoner?
I prefer to know whether he is bringing Aes Sedai down on us,
Jira put in. A large woman, gowned in gold-worked green silk. Fael's mother stood as tall as any maiden there, except Samara. Long black hair slashed with white at the temples, her nose only a little less bold than her husband's. Truth, she could give him lessons in looking fierce, and she was very like her daughter in one respect. Her loyalty was to her husband, not Rand.
You've taken Aes Sedai prisoner? Are we now to expect the entire White Tower to descend upon our heads?
If they do, Malayne said sharply, adjusting her shawl, they will be dealt with as they deserve. Sun-haired, green-eyed and beautiful, no more than a handful of years older than Rand by her face, she was a wise one and married to Bael. Whatever had caused the wise ones to change their view of Aes Sedai, Malayne, Amys, and Bear had changed the most.
What I wish to know, the third woman said, is what you will do about Kolaver Saigon.
While Dira and Malayne had presence, great presence, Dorinda outshone both, though it was difficult to see how exactly. The roofmistress of Smoke Springs Hold was a solid, motherly woman, much nearer handsome than pretty, with creases at the corners of her blue eyes and as much white in her pale red hair as Bael had gray. Yet of the three women, any eye with a brain behind it would have said she held sway.
Malayne says that Bear considers Kolaver Saigon of little importance, Dorinda went on. But wise ones can be as blind as any man when it comes to seeing the battle ahead and missing the scorpion underfoot.
A smile from Malayne robbed the words of their sting. Malayne's answering smile certainly said she took none.
A roof mistress's work is finding those scorpions before anyone is stung.
She also was Bael's wife, a fact that still disconcerted Rand, for all it had been her choice and Malayne's. Perhaps partly because it had been theirs. Among Aiel, a man had little say if his wife chose a sister wife. It was not a common arrangement, even among them.
Kolaver has taken up farming, Rand growled.
They blinked at him, wondering whether that was a joke.
The Sun Throne is empty again, and waiting for Elaine.
He considered weaving a ward against listeners, but a ward could be detected by anyone searching, man or woman, and its presence would announce that something interesting was being said. Well, everything said here would be known from the Dragon Wall to the sea soon enough. Fedwin was already rubbing his wrists while Jelani sheathed her knife. No one looked at them twice. All eyes were on Rand. Frowning at Neralia, he waggled his bound hands until Sulan sliced the cords. I didn't realize this was to be a family gathering. Neralia looked a trifle abashed, maybe, but no one else did.
After you marry, Davram murmured with a smile, you will learn you must choose very carefully what to keep from your wife.
Dira glanced down at him, pursing her lips.
Wives are a great comfort, Bael laughed. If a man does not tell them too much.
Smiling, Dorinda ran her fingers into his hair and gripped for a moment as though she meant to tug his head off. Bael grunted, but not for Dorinda's fingers alone. Malayne wiped her small belt knife on her heavy skirt and sheathed it. The two women grinned at one another over his head while he rubbed at his shoulder, where a small spot of blood stained his cotton sore. Dira nodded thoughtfully. It seemed she had just gotten an idea.
What woman could I hate enough to marry her to the Dragon Reborn? Rand said coldly.
That caused a silence solid enough to touch. He tried to take rein on his anger. He should have expected this. Malayne was not just a wise one. She was a dreamwalker, as were Amys and Bear. Among other things, they could talk to one another in their dreams, and to others. A useful skill, though they had only used it for him once. It was Wise One's business. No wonder at all that Malayne was abreast of everything that had happened. No wonder that she told Dorinda everything. Wise One's business or no, the two women were best friends and sisters rolled into one. Once Malayne let Bael know of the kidnapping, of course he had told Bashir. Expecting Bashir to keep that from his wife was like expecting him to keep it secret that their house was on fire. Inch by inch, he drew the anger in, forced it down.
Has Elaine arrived?
He tried to make his voice casual, and missed. No matter. There were reasons everyone knew for him to be anxious. Andor might not be as unquiet as Kyrian, but Elaine on the throne was the fastest way to settle both lands. Maybe the only way.
Not yet, Bashir shrugged. But tales have come north of Aes Sedai with an army somewhere in Murindi, or maybe Altara. That could be young Matt and his Band of the Red Hand, with the daughter heir and the sisters who fled the tower when Swan Sanche was deposed.
Rand rubbed his wrists where the cords had chafed. All that captive rigmarole had been on the chance Elaine was here already. Elaine and Avienda. So he could come and go without them learning of it till he was gone. Maybe he would have found a way to peek at them. Maybe... He was a fool, and no maybe about that.
Do you mean those sisters to swear oath to you, too?
Dira's tone was icy as her face. She did not like him. As she saw it, her husband had set off down a road that likely would end with his head on a pike over a gate in Tarvalin, and Rand had put his feet on that road.
The White Tower will not hold still for your coercing Aes Sedai.
Rand made her a small bow, and burn her if she took it for mocking. Dira Nir-Galeen Tabashir never gave him a title, never even used his name. She could as well have been talking to a footman, and not a very intelligent or trustworthy one. Should they choose to swear, I'll accept their oaths. I doubt many are exactly eager to return to Tarvalin. If they choose otherwise, they can go their own way so long as they don't put themselves against me.
The White Tower has put itself against you, Bale said, leaning forward with his fists on his knees.
His blue eyes made Dira's voice seem warm.
An enemy who comes once will come again, unless they are stopped. My spears will follow wherever the Karakarn leads.
Mullane nodded, of course. She very likely wanted every last Aes Sedai shielded and kneeling under guard, if not bound hand and foot. But Dorinda nodded as well, and Sulin, and Bashir knuckled his mustaches thoughtfully. Rand did not know whether to laugh or weep.
Don't you think I've enough on my plate without a war against the White Tower? Elida grabbed my throat and was slapped down.
The ground erupting in fire and torn flesh. Ravens and vultures gorging. How many dead? Slapped down.
If she has sense enough to stop there, I will too.
So long as they did not ask him to trust. The chest. He was shaking his head, half aware of Luz Theron suddenly moaning about the dark and the thirst. He could ignore. He had to ignore. But not forget. Or trust. Leaving Bail and Bashir arguing over whether Elida did have sense enough to stop, now that she had begun, he moved to a map-covered table against the wall, beneath the tapestry of some battle where the white line of Andor stood prominent. Apparently Bail and Bashir used this room for their planning. A little rooting around found the map he needed, a large roll displaying all of Andor from the Mountains of Mist to the River Arranin, and parts of the lands to the south as well, Ghilladan and Altara and Murindi.
The women held captive in the Tree Killer's lands are allowed to cause no trouble, so why should any others?
Mullane said, apparently in answer to something he had not heard. She sounded angry.
We will do what we must, Dira Tabashir,
Dorinda said calmly. She was seldom anything but.
Hold to your courage, and we will arrive where we must go. When you leap from a cliff, Dira replied, it is too late for anything but holding to your courage, and hoping there's a haywain at the bottom to land in.
Her husband chuckled as though she was making a joke. She did not sound it. Spreading the map out and weighting the corners with ink jars and sand bottles, Rand measured off distances with his fingers. Matt was not moving very fast if rumor placed him in Altara or Murindi. He took pride in how fast the band could march. Maybe the Aes Sedai were slowing him, with servants and wagons. Maybe there were more sisters than he had thought. Rand realized his hands were clenched into fists and made them straighten. He needed Elaine to take the throne here and in Kyrian. That was why he needed her. Just that. Avienda. He did not need her, not at all, and she had made it clear she had no need for him. She was safe away from him. He could keep them both safe by keeping them as far from him as possible. Light, if he could only look at them. He needed Matt, though, with Perrin being stubborn. He was not sure how Matt had suddenly become expert on everything to do with battle, but even Bashir respected Matt's opinions. About war, anyway. They treated him as Datsang, Sulin growled, and some of the other maidens growled wordlessly in echo.
We know, Malaine said grimly. They have no honor.
Will he truly hold back after what you describe? Dira demanded in disbelieving tones.
The map did not extend far enough south to show Ilion. No map on the table showed any part of that country, but Rand's hand drifted down across Murundi, and he could imagine the Dwalon Hills, not far inside Ilion's borders, with a line of hill forts no invading army could afford to ignore. And some 250 miles to the east, across the plains of Moredo, an army such as had not been seen since the nations gathered before Tarvalin in the Aiel War, maybe not since Arthur Hawkwing's day. Tyrin, Kyrianen, Aiel, all poised to smash into Ilion. If Perrin would not lead, then Matt must. Only there was not enough time. There was never enough time.
Burn my eyes, Davram muttered. You never mentioned that, Malaine. Lady Caroline and Lord Toram camped right outside the city, and High Lord Darlin as well. They didn't come together by chance. Not right at this time, they did not. That's a pit of vipers to have on your doorstep, whoever you are.
Let the Algaid Siswai dance, Bale replied. Dead vipers bite no one.
Samael had always been at his best defending. That was Luz Theron's memory, from the War of the Shadow. With two men inside one skull, maybe it was to be expected that memories would drift between them. Had Luz Theron suddenly found himself recalling herding sheep, or cutting firewood, or feeding the chickens? Rand could hear him faintly, raging to kill, to destroy. Thoughts of the Forsaken almost always drove Luz Theron over the brink.
Dira Tabashir speaks truly, Bale said. We must stay on the path we have begun until our enemies are destroyed, or we are.
That is not how I meant it, Dira said dryly. But you are right. We have no choice now, until our enemies are destroyed, or we are.
Death, destruction, and madness floated in Rand's head as he studied the map. Samael would be at those forts soon after the army struck. Samael with the strength of a Forsaken and the knowledge of the Age of Legends. Lord Brend, he called himself, one of the Council of Nine, and Lord Brend they called him who refused to admit the Forsaken were loose. But Rand knew him. With Luz Theron's memory he knew Samael's face, knew him to the bone.
What does Dailan Taravin intend with Naon Aron and Alenia Sarand?
Dorinda asked.
I do confess I do not understand this shutting people away.
What she does there is hardly important, Davram said. It is her meetings with those Aes Sedai that concern me.
Dailan Taravin is a fool, Malaine muttered. She believes the rumors about the Karakhan kneeling to the Amalyn seat. She will not brush her hair unless those Aes Sedai give her permission.
You mistake her, Dira said firmly. Dailan is strong enough to rule Andor. She proved that at Arengil. Of course she listens to the Aes Sedai. Only a fool ignores Aes Sedai. But to listen is not to obey.
The wagons that had been brought from Dumai's Wells would have to be searched again. The fat little man Angreal had to be there somewhere. None of the sisters who escaped could have had a clue what it was. Unless, perhaps, one had stuck a souvenir of the dragon reborn in her pouch. No. It had to be in the wagon somewhere. With that, he was more than a match for any of the Forsaken. Without it,
Death, destruction, and madness.
Suddenly, what he had been hearing rushed forward.
What was that?
He demanded, turning from the ivory-inlaid table. Surprised faces turned toward him. Jonan straightened from where he had been slouching against the doorframe. The maidens, squatting easily on their heels, suddenly appeared alert. They had been talking idly among themselves. Even they were wary around him now. Fingering one of her ivory necklaces, Malaine shared a decided look between Bale and Davram, then spoke before anyone else.
There are 9 Aes Sedai at an inn called the Silver Swan, in what Davram Bashir calls the New City.
She said the word inn in an odd way, and city as well. She had only known them from books before coming across the Dragon Wall.
He and Bale say we must leave them alone until they do something against you. I think you have learned about waiting for Aes Sedai, Randall Thor.
My fault, Bashir sighed, if fault there is. Though what Malaine expects to do, I can't say. 8 sisters stopped at the Silver Swan almost a month ago, just after you left. Now and then a few more come or go, but there are never more than 10 at one time. They keep to themselves, cause no trouble, and ask no questions that Bale or I can learn. A few Red Sisters have come into the city as well. 2. Those at the Silver Swan all have warders, but these never do. I'm sure they are Reds. 2 or 3 appear, ask after men heading for the Black Tower, and after a day or so they leave. Without learning much, I'd say. That Black Tower is as good as a fortress for holding in secrets. None of them has made trouble, and I would rather not trouble them until I know it is necessary.
I didn't mean that, Rand said slowly.
He sat down in a chair opposite Bashir, gripping the carved arms till his knuckles hurt. Aes Sedai gathering here, Aes Sedai gathering in Kyrian. Happenstance? Luthien rumbled like thunder on the horizon about death and betrayal. He would have to warn Taim. Not about the Aes Sedai at the Silver Swan. Taim certainly knew already. Why had he not mentioned it? About staying away from them, keeping the Ashaman away. If Demise Wells was to be an end, there could be no new beginnings here. Too many things seemed to be spinning out of control. The harder he tried to gather them all in, the more there were, and the faster they spun. Sooner or later, everything was going to fall and shatter. The thought dried his throat. Tom Marilyn had taught him to juggle a little, but he had never been very good. Now he had to be very good indeed. He wished he had something to wet his throat. He did not realize he had spoken that last aloud until Jelani straightened from her crouch and strutted across the room to where a tall silver pitcher stood on a small table. Filling a hammered silver goblet, she brought it back to Rand with a smile, her mouth opening as she proffered it. He expected something rude, but a change came over her face. All she said was, "Karakarn," then went back to her place with the other maidens, so dignified it seemed she was imitating Dorinda, or maybe Dira. Samara gestured in hand talk, and suddenly every maiden was red-faced and biting her lips to keep from laughing. Every maiden but Jelani, who was just red-faced. The wine punch tasted of plums. Rand could remember fat, sweet plums from the orchard across the river when he was young, climbing the trees to pick them himself. Tilting his head back, he drained the goblet. There were plum trees in the 2 rivers, but no orchards of them, and certainly not across any river.
"Keep your bloody memories to yourself," he snarled at Luthien.
The man in his head laughed at something, giggling quietly to himself. Bashir frowned at the maidens, then glanced at Bale and his wives, all impassive as stone, and shook his head. He got on well with Bale, but Aiel in general mystified him.
"Since no one is bringing me any drink," he said, rising, and went to pour his own.
He took a long swallow that wet his heavy mustaches.
"Now that's cooling. Taim's way of enrolling men seems to sweep up every fellow who'd like to follow the Dragon Reborn. He has delivered a goodly army to me, men who lack whatever it is your Ashaman need. They all talk wide-eyed about walking through holes in the air, but none has been anywhere near the Black Tower. I'm trying out a few thoughts young Matt had."
Rand waved that away with the empty goblet.
Tell me about Dailin.
Dailin of House Taravin would be next in line for the throne should anything happen to Elaine. But he had told her he was having Elaine brought to Camelin. If she thinks she can take the Lion Throne, I can find a farm for her, too.
Take the throne?
Dira said incredulously, and her husband laughed out loud.
I have no understanding of Wetlander ways, Vale said, but I do not think that is what she has done.
Far from it!
Davram carried the pitcher over to pour more punch for Rand.
Some lesser lords and ladies who thought to curry favor proclaimed for her at Arengil. She moves quickly, Lady Dailin. Within 4 days she had the two leaders hanged, for treason to the daughter heir Elaine, and ordered another 20 flogged.
He chuckled approvingly. His wife sniffed. Likely she would have had the road lined with gibbets all the way from Arengil to Camelin. Then what was that about her ruling Andor? Rand demanded. And imprisoning Elenia and Neon.
They are the ones who tried to claim the throne,
Dira said, dark eyes sparkling angrily. Bashir nodded. He was much calmer.
Only 3 days ago, when word arrived of Kolaver's coronation, and the rumors from Kyrian that you had gone to Tar Valon began to sound more real. With trade beginning again, there are so many pigeons in the air between Kyrian and Camelin you could walk on their backs.
Putting the pitcher back, he returned to his chair.
Neon proclaimed for the Lion Throne in the morning, Elenia before midday, and by sunset Dailin, Elevar, and Luon had arrested them both. They announced Dailin as regent the next morning, in Elaine's name, until Elaine returns. Most of the houses of Andor have declared support for Dailin. I think some would like to have her take the throne herself, but Arengil keeps even the most powerful careful of their tongues.
Closing one eye, Bashir pointed at Rand.
You, they do not mention at all. Whether that is good or bad, it will take a wiser head than mine to say.
Dira offered a cool smile, looking down that nose of hers.
Those lick-spittles you allowed to make free of the palace have all fled the city, it seems. Fled Andor, some of them, according to rumor. You should know, they were all behind either Elenia or Neon.
Rand carefully set his full goblet on the floor beside his chair. He had only let Lyra and Aramilla and the rest remain, in order to try pushing Dailin and those who supported her into cooperation with him. They would never have left Andor to the likes of Lord Lyra. With time, and Elaine's return, it might yet work. But everything was whirling faster and faster, whirling away from his fingers. There were a few things he could control, though.
Bedwin there is an Ashaman, he said. He can bring messages to me in Kyrian if there's need.
That with a glare from Elaine, who returned the blandest sort of look. Dira studied Fedwin as she might a dead rat some overeager dog had dropped on her rug. Davram and Bale were more considering. Fedwin tried to stand straighter under their gaze.
"Don't let anyone know who he is," Rand went on. "No one. That's why he isn't wearing black. I am taking two more to Lord Samaradrid and High Lord Wyroman tonight. They'll have need when they face Samael in the Dwarlon Hills. I will be busy chewing on Kyrian for a while yet, it seems. And maybe Andor, too."
"Does this mean you will send the spears forward at last?" Bale said. "You give the orders tonight?"
Rand nodded, and Bashir gave a great hoot of laughter.
"Now that calls for a good wine. Or it would if it wasn't hot enough to make a man's blood thick as porridge."
Laughter slid into a grimace.
"Burn me, but I wish I could be there. Still, I suppose holding Camelin for the Dragon Reborn is no small thing."
"You always want to be where the swords are bared, my husband."
Dira sounded quite fond.
"The fifth," Bale said. "You will allow the fifth in Ilion, when Samael has fallen?"
Aiel custom allowed taking the fifth part of all that was in a place, taken by force of arms. Rand had forbidden it here in Camelin. He would not give Elaine a city looted even that much. "They will have the fifth," Rand said. But it was not of Samael or Ilion that he thought.
"Bring Elaine quickly, Matt."
It ran wild in his head, across Luz Theron's cackling.
"Bring her quickly, before Andor and Carrion both erupt in my face."
Chapter 8 The Figurehead. "We must stop here tomorrow." Egwene shifted carefully on her folding chair. It had a tendency to fold on its own sometimes. "Lord Bryn says the army is running short of food. Our camp is certainly short of everything." Two stubby tallow candles burned on the wooden table in front of her. That folded, too, for easy packing, but it was sturdier than the chair. The candles in the tent that served as her study were supplemented by an oil lantern hanging from the center pole up near the peak. The dim yellow light flickered, making faint shadows dance on patched canvas walls that were a far cry from the grandeur of the Ammerlin's study in the White Tower, but that did not upset her. Truth be known, she herself was some considerable distance short of the grandeur normally associated with the Ammerlin seat. She knew very well that the seven-striped stole on her shoulders was the only reason any stranger would believe her Ammerlin, if they did not think it an extremely foolish joke. Odd things had happened in the White Tower's history. Swan had told her secret details of some of them, yet surely nothing so odd as her. 4 or 5 days would be better, Shiriam mused, studying the sheaf of papers in her lap. Slightly plump, with high cheekbones and tilted green eyes, in her dark green riding dress she managed to look elegant and commanding, despite her perch on one of the two precarious stools in front of the table. Exchange her narrow blue stole of the Keeper of the Chronicles for the Ammerlin's, and anyone would think she wore it by right. Sometimes she certainly seemed to believe the striped stole rested on her own shoulders. Or perhaps longer. It would not hurt to build our stores up once more. Swan, atop the other rickety stool, shook her head slightly, but Egwene did not need the hint. One day. She might be just 18 and well short of a true Ammerlin's grandeur, but she was no fool. Too many of the sisters seized on any excuse for a halt, too many of the sitters as well, and if they stopped too long, it might be impossible to start them moving again. Shiriam opened her mouth. "One, daughter," Egwene said firmly. Whatever Shiriam thought, the fact was that Shiriam Bayanar was the keeper and Egwene Alvir the Ammerlin. If only Shiriam could be brought to realize that. And the Hall of the Tower, they were worse. She wanted to snarl or snap or maybe throw something, but after close to a month and a half, she already had a lifetime's practice in keeping her face and voice smooth at far greater provocation than this. "Any longer and we'll begin to strip the countryside bare. I won't leave people to starve. On the practical side, if we take too much from them, even paid for, they'll give us 100 problems in return. Raids on the herds and flocks, and thieves at the store wagons," Swan murmured. Studying her divided gray skirts, not looking at anyone, she seemed to be thinking aloud. "Men shooting at our guards at night, maybe setting fire to whatever they can reach. A bad business. Hungry people become desperate in a hurry." Those were the same reasons Lord Bryn had given Egwene in very nearly the same words. The fiery-haired woman shot Swan a hard look. Many sisters had a difficult time with Swan. Her face was probably the best known in the camp, young enough to have looked proper above an accepted's dress, or a novice's for that matter. That was a side effect of being stilled, though not many had known it. Swan could hardly walk a step without sisters staring at her, the once Ammerlin seat, deposed and cut off from Sidar, then healed and restored to at least some ability, when everyone knew that was impossible. Many welcomed her back warmly as a sister once more, for herself and for the miracle that held out hope against what every Aes Sedai feared beyond death. But just as many or more offered lukewarm toleration or condescension or both, blaming her for their present situation. Shiriam was one of those who thought Swan should instruct the new young Ammerlin in protocol and the like, which everyone believed she hated, and keep her mouth closed unless she was called upon. She was less than she had been, no longer Amarlin, and no longer anywhere near so strong in the power. It was not cruelty as Aes Sedai saw it. The past was past. What was now was, and must be accepted. Anything else only brought greater pain. By and large, Aes Sedai admitted change slowly, but once they did, for most, it was as if things had always been that way. "One day, Mother, as you say," Shiriam sighed at last, bowing her head slightly. Less in submission, Egwene was sure, than to hide a grimace over her stubbornness. She would accept the grimace if the acquiescence came with it. For the time being, she had to. Swan bowed her head, too, to hide a smile. Any sister might be appointed to any post, but the social pecking order was quite rigid, and Swan stood a long way further down than she had. That was one reason. The papers on Shiriam's lap were duplicated on Swan's, and on the table in front of Egwene. Reports on everything from the number of candles and sacks of beans remaining in the camp to the state of the horses, and the same for Lord Bryn's army. The army's camp encircled the Aes Sedai's, with a ring perhaps 20 steps wide between, but in many ways they might as well have been a mile apart. Surprisingly, Lord Bryn insisted on that as much as the sisters. The Aes Sedai did not want soldiers wandering among their tents, a lot of unwashed, illiterate ruffians with light fingers often as not, and it seemed the soldiers did not want Aes Sedai wandering among them either, though, perhaps wisely, they held their reasons close. They marched toward Tar Valon to pull down a usurper to the Amarlin seat and raise Egwene in her place, yet few men were truly comfortable around Aes Sedai, few enough women either. As keeper, Shiriam would have been all too happy to take these minor matters out of Egwene's hands. She had said as much, explaining how minor they were, how the Amarlin seat should not be burdened with day-to-day trifles. Swan, on the other hand, said a good Amarlin paid attention to just those, not trying to duplicate the work of dozens of sisters and clerks, yet checking on something different every day. That way she had a good idea of what was happening and what needed doing before someone came running to her with a crisis already breaking into shards. A feel for how the wind was blowing, Swan called it. Making sure these reports reached her had required weeks, and Egwene was sure that once she let them pass to Shiriam's control, she would never again learn anything until it was long dealt with, if then. A silence stretched as they began reading the next paper in each stack. They were not alone. Chesa, seated on cushions to one side of the tent, spoke. "Too little light is bad for the eyes," she murmured almost to herself, holding up one of Egwene's silk stockings that she was darning. "You'll never catch me ruining my eyes over words in this little light." Just short of stout, with a twinkle in her eyes and a merry smile, Egwene's maid was always trying to slip advice to the Amarlin, as though talking about herself. She could have been in Egwene's service 20 years, instead of less than 2 months, and 3 times as old as Egwene, instead of barely twice. Tonight, Egwene suspected that she talked to fill silences. There was a tension in the camp since Loghain had escaped. A man who could channel, shielded and under close guard, yet he had slipped away like fog. Everyone walked on edge, wondering how, wondering where he was, what he intended to do now. Egwene wished harder than most that she could be sure she knew where Loghain Ablar was. Giving her papers a firm snap of her wrists, Shiriam frowned at Chesa. She did not understand why Egwene let her maid be present at these meetings, much less let her chatter away freely. It probably never occurred to her that Chesa's presence and her unexpected chatter frequently unsettled her just enough to help Egwene sidestep advice she did not want to take, and postpone decisions she did not want to make, at least not the way Shiriam wanted them made. Certainly the notion had never occurred to Chesa. She smiled apologetically and returned to her darning, occasionally murmuring to herself. "If we continue, Mother," Shiriam said coolly, "we may finish before dawn." Staring at the next page, Egwene rubbed her temples. Chesa might be right about the light. She had another headache coming on. Then again, it might be the page, detailing what money was left. The stories she had read never mentioned how much coin was required to keep an army. Pinned to the sheet were notes from two of the sitters, Romanda and Lilaine, suggesting the soldiers be paid less frequently. Paid less, in fact. More than suggesting, really, just as Romanda and Lilaine were more than simply two sitters in the hall. Other sitters followed where they led, if not all by any means, while the only sitter Egwene could count on was Delana, and her not far. It was rare that Lilaine and Romanda agreed on anything, and they could hardly have chosen a worse. Some of the soldiers had sworn oaths, yet most were there for their pay, and maybe the hope of loot. "The soldiers are to be paid as before," Egwene muttered, crumpling the two notes. She was not going to let her army melt away, any more than she would allow looting. "As you command, mother." Shiriam's eyes sparkled with pleasure. The difficulties must be clear to her. Anyone who thought her less than very intelligent was in deep trouble, but she did have a blind spot. If Romanda or Lilaine said the sun was coming up, Shiriam most likely would claim it was going down. She had had almost as much sway with the hall as they did now, perhaps more, until they put a halt to it between them. The opposite was true as well. Those two would speak against anything Shiriam wanted before they stopped to think, which had its uses, all in all. Egwene's fingers tapped on the tabletop, but she made them stop. The money had to be found, somewhere, somehow, but she did not have to let Shiriam see her worry. "That new woman will work out," Chesa murmured over her sewing. "Tyrants always carry their noses high, of course, but Selene does know what's required of a lady's maid. Mary and I will settle her down soon enough." Shiriam rolled her eyes irritably. Egwene smiled to herself. Egwene Alvear with three maids waiting on her, as unbelievable as the stole itself. But the smile lasted only a heartbeat. Maids had to be paid, too. A tiny sum, balanced against 30,000 soldiers, and the Ammerlin could hardly do her own laundry or mend her own shifts. But she could have managed splendidly with Chesa alone, and would have, had she any choice in it. Less than a week earlier, Romanda had decided that the Ammerlin needed another servant and found Mary among the refugees who huddled in every village until they were chased away. And, not to be outdone, Lilaine produced Selene from the same source. The two women were crowded into Chesa's small tent before Egwene knew either existed. The principle of the thing was wrong. Three maids when there was not enough silver to pay the army halfway to Tar Valon. Servants chosen for her without any say. And then there was the fact that she had yet another, if one who received not a copper. Everyone believed Marigan was the Ammerlin's maid-servant anyway. Beneath the edge of the table she felt her belt pouch, felt the bracelet inside. She should wear it more. It was a duty. Keeping her hands low, she dug the bracelet out and slipped it around her wrist. A band of silver made so the catch was invisible once closed. Made with the one power, the bracelet snapped shut beneath the table, and she very nearly snatched it off again. Emotion flooded into a corner of her mind. Emotion and awareness. A little pocket, as if she were imagining it. Emotion flooded into a corner of her mind. Emotion and awareness. A little pocket, as if she were imagining it. Not imagination, though. All too real. Half of an eidom, the bracelet created a link between her and the woman who wore the other half, a silver necklace the wearer could not remove herself. They were a circle of two without embracing Sidar, Egwene always leading by virtue of the bracelet. Marigan was asleep now, her feet sore from walking all day and days past, but even sleeping, fear oozed through most strongly. Only hate ever came near fear in the stream that flowed through the eidom. Egwene's reluctance came from the constant gnawing of the other woman's terror, from having worn the necklace end of the eidom once, and from knowing the woman on the far end. She hated sharing any part of her. Only three women in the camp knew that Mogedion was a prisoner, hidden in the midst of Aes Sedai. If it came out, Mogedion would be tried, stilled, and executed in short order. If it came out, Egwene might not be far behind her, and Swan and Lyanna as well. They were the other two who knew. At best, she would have the stole stripped away. For hiding one of the Forsaken from justice, she thought grimly, I'll be lucky if they just stick me back with the accepted. Unconsciously, she thumbed the golden great serpent ring on the first finger of her right hand. Then again, however just such a punishment might be, it was unlikely. She'd been taught that the wisest of the sisters was chosen Ammerlin's seat, yet she had learned better. The choosing of an Ammerlin was as hotly contested as electing a mayor in the Two Rivers, and maybe more. No one bothered to stand against her father in Emmons Field, but she had heard about elections in Devon Ride and Tarran Ferry. Swan had only been raised Ammerlin because the three before her each had died after just a few years on the Ammerlin seat. The Hall had wanted someone young. Speaking of age to a sister was at least as rude as slapping her face, yet she had begun to get some idea how long Aes Sedai lived. Rarely was anyone chosen sitter before she had worn the shawl 70 or 80 years at least, and Ammerlin's generally longer, often much longer. So when the Hall deadlocked between four sisters raised Aes Sedai less than 50 years before, and Cian Harriman of the White suggested a woman who had worn the shawl only 10 years, it might have been as much exhaustion as Swan's qualifications in administration that brought the sitters to stand for her. And Egwene Alvere, who in many eyes should still have been a novice? A figurehead, easily directed, a child who had grown up in the same village with Randall Thor. That last definitely had its part in the decision. They would not take back the stole, but she would find the little authority she had managed to accumulate gone. Romanda, Lelaine, and Shiria might actually come to blows over which would march her about by the scruff of her neck. "That looks much like a bracelet I saw Elaine wearing." The papers on Shiriam's lap crackled as she leaned forward for a better look. "And Nynaeve. They shared it, as I recall." Egwene gave a start. She had been careless. "It's the same. A remembrance gift when they left." Twisting the silver circlet around her wrist, she felt a stab of guilt that was all her own. The bracelet appeared segmented, but so cunningly you could not see how exactly. She had hardly thought of Nynaeve and Elaine since their departure for Ebu Dar. Perhaps she should call them back. Their search was not going well, it seemed, though they denied it. Still, if they could find what they were after... Shiriam was frowning, whether or not at the bracelet, Egwene could not say. She could not allow Shiriam to start thinking too much on that bracelet, though. If she ever noticed that the necklace Maragon wore was a match, there might be painfully awkward questions. Rising, Egwene smoothed her skirt as she moved around the table. Swan had acquired several pieces of information today. One could be put to good use now. She was not the only one with secrets. Shiriam looked surprised when she stopped too close for the other woman to stand. "Daughter, I've learned that a few days after Swan and Lyanna arrived in Salidar, 10 sisters left, 2 from each Aja there, except the Blue. Where did they go, and why?" Shiriam's eyes narrowed a fraction, but she wore serenity as comfortably as her dress. "Mother, I can hardly recall every..." "No dancing around, Shiriam." Egwene moved a little closer, until their knees almost touched. "No lies by omission. The truth." A frown creased Shiriam's smooth forehead. "Mother, even if I knew, you cannot trouble yourself with every little..." "The truth, Shiriam. The whole truth. Must I ask before the entire Hall why I cannot have the truth from my keeper? I will have it, daughter, one way or another. I will have it." Shiriam's head swiveled as though she was looking for a way to escape. Her eyes fell on Chesa, hunched over her sewing, and she all but gasped with relief. "Mother, tomorrow, when we are alone, I am sure I can explain everything to your satisfaction. I must speak with a few of the sisters first, so they could work up what Shiriam was to tell her tomorrow." "Chesa," Egwene said, "wait outside, please." For all that she seemed focused on her work to the exclusion of everything else, Chesa bounded to her feet in a flash and very nearly ran from the tent. When Aes Sedai were at odds, anyone with half a brain went elsewhere. "Now, daughter," Egwene said, "the truth, all that you know. This is as private as you will be," she added when Shiriam glanced at Swan. For a moment, Shiriam adjusted her skirts, plucking at them, really, avoiding Egwene's eyes, no doubt still working out evasions. But the three oaths trapped her. She could not speak an untrue word, and whatever she thought of Egwene's true position, slipping behind her back was a long way from denying her authority to her face. Even Romanda maintained the proper courtesies, if only by a hair at times. Drawing a deep breath, Shiriam folded her hands in her lap and spoke to Egwene's chest, matter of fact. When we learned the Red Aja was responsible for setting Loghain up as a false dragon, we felt something had to be done. We certainly meant the small coterie of sisters she had gathered around her. Carlinia and Beonin and the rest held as much real sway as most sitters, if not actually in the hall. Elida was sending out demands for every sister to return to the tower, so we chose 10 sisters to do just that, by the fastest means they could manage. They all should be there long since, quietly making sure that every sister in the tower understands the truth of what the Reds did with Loghain. Not, she hesitated, then finished in a rush. Not even the hall knows of them. Egwene stepped away, rubbing her temples again, quietly making sure, in the hope that Elida would be deposed. Not exactly a bad scheme, really. It might even work eventually. It might take years, too. But then for most sisters, the longer they could go without truly doing anything, the better. With enough time, they could convince the world that the White Tower had never really broken. It had been broken before, even if only a handful knew it. Maybe with enough time they could find a way to adjust everything so it had not, really. Why keep it from the hall, Shiriam? Surely you don't think any of them would betray your plan to Elida? Half the sisters eyed the other half askance for fear of Elida's sympathizers, partly for fear of that. Mother, a sister who decided that what we do is a mistake would hardly let herself be chosen a sitter. Any such would have taken herself away long since. Shiriam had not relaxed, but her voice took on the patient, instructing tone she seemed to think had the greatest effect on Egwene. Usually, though, she was more adroit at changing the subject. These suspicions are the worst problem we face for the time being. No one really trusts anyone. If we could only see how to... The Black Aja, Swan cut in quietly. That's what chills your blood like a silver pike up your skirts. Who can say for sure who is black, and who can say what a black sister might do? Shiriam darted another hard look at Swan, but after a moment the force went out of her, or rather one sort of tension replaced another. She glanced at Egwene, then nodded reluctantly. By the sour twist to her mouth, she would have made another evasion had it not been plain Egwene would not stand for it. Most sisters in the camp believed now, but after more than 3,000 years denying the Black Aja's existence, it was a queasy belief. Almost no one would open her mouth on that topic, no matter what they believed. The question, Mother, Swan went on, is what happens when the hall does find out. She seemed to be thinking aloud again. I can't see any sitter accepting the excuse that she couldn't be told because she might be on Elida's side. And as for the possibility she might be Black Aja, yes, I think they will be quite upset. Shiriam's face paled slightly. It was a wonder she did not go dead white. Upset did not begin to cover it. Yes, Shiriam would face much more than upset if this came out. Now was the time to drive home her advantage, but another question occurred to Egwene. If Shiriam and her friends had sent... What were they? Not spies. Ferrets, maybe, sent into the walls after rats. If Shiriam had sent ferrets into the White Tower, could... A sudden stab of pain through that pocket of sensations in the back of her head sent everything else flying. Had she felt it directly, it would have been numbing. As it was, her eyes bulged in shock. A man who could channel was touching the necklace around Mogedion's neck. This was one link no man could be brought into. Pain, and something unheard of from Mogedion. Hope. And then it was all gone. The awareness. The emotions. The necklace was off. I need some fresh air, she managed. Shiriam started to rise and Swan, but she waved them back down. No, I want to be alone, she said hastily. Swan, find out everything Shiriam knows about the ferrets. Light, I meant the 10 sisters. They both stared at her, but thanked the light neither followed as she snatched the lantern from its hook and hurried out. It would not do for the Ammerlin to be seen running, yet she came close, hoisting her divided skirts as well as she could with her free hand, and very nearly trotting. A cloudless sky made the moonlight bright, dappling the tents and wagons with shadows. Most people in the camp were asleep, but low fires still burned here and there. A handful of warders were about, a few servants, too many eyes to see if she ran. The last thing she wanted was someone offering help. She realized she was panting, but from alarm, not exertion. Thrusting her head and the lantern into Marigan's tiny tent, she found it empty. The blankets that made up the pallet on the ground lay in a sprawl, tossed aside by someone in a hurry. And what if she had still been here, she wondered, with the necklace off, and maybe whoever freed her. Shivering, she withdrew slowly. Mogedion had good reason to dislike her, very personally, and the only sister who could match one of the Forsaken alone when she could channel at all was in Ebudar. Mogedion could have killed Egwene without anyone noticing. Even had a sister felt her channel, there would be nothing remarkable in that. Worse, Mogedion might not have killed her, and no one would have known anything until they found the pair of them gone. Mother, Chesa fussed behind her. You should not be out in the night air. Night air is bad air. If you wanted Marigan, I could have fetched her. Egwene very nearly jumped. She had not been aware of Chesa following her. She studied the people at the nearest fires. They had gathered for companionship, not warmth in this unholy heat, and they were not close, but maybe someone had seen who went into Marigan's tent. She certainly had few visitors, and no men among them. A man might well have been remarked. I think she has run away, Chesa. Why, that wicked woman! Chesa exclaimed. I always said she had a mean air and a sneaking eye, slinking away like a thief after you took her in. She'd be starving by a road if not for you. No gratitude at all. She followed all the way back to the tent where Egwene slept, nattering on about wickedness in general, the thanklessness of Marigan in particular, and how that sort should be handled, which seemed to jump between switching them till they settled down and tossing them out before they could run away. Tucked around cautions that Egwene check her jewelry to be sure it was all still there. Egwene barely heard. Her mind spun. It could not have been low gain, could it? He could not have known about Mogedion, much less come back to rescue her. Could he? Those men Rand was gathering, those Ashaman. Rumor in every village carried whispers of Ashaman and the Black Tower. Most of the sisters tried to pretend they were unaffected by dozens of men who could channel gathering in one spot. The worst of the tales had to be inflated, rumor always exaggerated. But Egwene's toes wanted to curl under with fright whenever she thought of them. An Ashaman could have. But why? How would he have known any more than Loghain? She was trying to avoid the only reasonable conclusion. Something far worse than Loghain had come back, or even Ashaman. One of the Forsaken had freed Mogedion. Ravine was dead by Rand's hand, according to Nynaeve, and he had killed Ishamael as well, or so it seemed. And Aginor and Balthamel. Moiraine had killed Baelal. That left only Asmodian, Demondred, and Samael among the men. Samael was in Ilion. No one knew where the others were, or any of the women who survived. Moiraine had done for Lanfear, too, or they had done for each other. But all the other women were still alive, so far as anyone knew. Forget the women. It had been a man. Which? Plans had been laid long since in case one of the Forsaken struck at the camp. No one sister here could equal any of the Forsaken by herself. But linked in circles was another matter, and any Forsaken who stepped into their camp would find circles forming on every side of him, or her, once they realized who she was. The Forsaken showed no signs of agelessness, for some reason. Maybe it was some effect of being connected to the Dark One. This was dithering. She had to start thinking clearly. Chesa? Look like you need your head rubbed for the ache again, is what you... Yes, Mother? Find Swan and Lyanna. Tell them to come to me, but don't let anyone hear you. Grinning, Chesa dropped a curtsy and scampered out. She could hardly avoid knowing the currents that swirled around Egwene, yet she found all the plotting and scheming fun. Not that she knew more than surface, and little enough of that. Egwene did not doubt her loyalty, But Chase's opinion of what was exciting might change if she learned the depth of those swirls. Channeling the oil lamps inside the tent alight, Egwene blew out the lantern and set it carefully in a corner. Maybe she had to think clearly, but she still felt as if she was stumbling in the dark. Chapter 9. A Pair of Silver Pike. Egwene was sitting in her chair, one of the few real chairs in the camp, with a little plain carving like a farmer's best armchair, roomy and comfortable enough that she felt only a touch of guilt about taking up valuable wagon space for it. She was sitting there trying to pull her thoughts together when Swan swept aside the entry flaps and ducked into the tent. Swan was not happy. "Why in the light did you run off?" Her voice had not changed with her face, and she chided with the best even when she did it in respectful tones, barely respectful. Her blue eyes remained the same, too. They could have done for a saddle-maker's awls. "Shiriam brushed me aside like a fly." That surprisingly delicate mouth twisted bitterly. "She was gone almost as soon as you were. Don't you realize she handed herself to you? She certainly does. Her and Anayand Morvrin and the lot of them. You can be sure they'll spend tonight trying to bail water and patch holes. They could manage it. I don't see how, but they might." Almost as the last word left her mouth, Lyanna entered. A tall, willowy woman, her coppery face was as youthful as Swan's, and for the same reason. She also was more than old enough to be Egwene's mother, in truth. Lyanna took one look at Swan and threw up her hands as much as the roof of the tent would allow. "Mother, this is a foolish risk." Her dark eyes went from dreamy to flashing, but her voice had a languorous quality even when she was irritated. Once it had been brisk. "If anyone sees Swan and me together this way..." "I don't care if the whole camp learns your squabbling is a fraud," Egwene broke in sharply, weaving a small barrier against eavesdropping around the three of them. It could be worked through with time, but not without detection, so long as she held the weave instead of tying it off. She did care, and perhaps she should not have called them both, but her first half-coherent thought had been to summon the two sisters she could count on. No one in the camp so much as suspected. Everyone knew the former Amerlin and her former keeper detested one another every bit as much as Swan detested being tutor to her successor. Should any sister uncover the truth, they might well find themselves doing penance for a long time to come, and not an easy one. Aes Sedai appreciated being made fools of even less than other people. Kings had been made to pay for that. But in the meanwhile, their supposed animosity resulted in a certain leverage with the other sisters, including sitters. If they both said the same thing, it must be so. Another incidental effect of being stilled was very useful, one no one else knew about. The three oaths no longer held them. They could lie like wool merchants now. Schemes and deceptions on every side. The camp was like some fetid swamp where strange growths sprouted unseen in mists. Maybe anywhere Aes Sedai gathered was like that. After 3,000 years of plotting, however necessary, it was hardly surprising that scheming had become second nature to most sisters, and only a breath away for the rest. The truly horrible thing was that she found herself beginning to enjoy all the machinations. Not for their own sake, but as puzzles, though no twisted bits of iron could intrigue her a quarter so much. What that said about her she did not want to know. Well, she was Aes Sedai, whatever anyone thought, and she had to take the bad of it with the good. "Mogedion has escaped," she went on without pause. "A man removed the Eidam from her, a man who can channel. I think one of them took the necklace away. It wasn't in her tent, that I saw. There might be some way to find it using the bracelet, but if there is, I don't know it." That took the starch right out of them. Lyanna's legs gave way, and she dropped like a sack onto the stool Chaser sometimes used. Swan sat down on the cot slowly, back very straight, hands very still on her knees. Incongruously, Egwene noticed that her dress had tiny blue flowers embroidered in a wide Tyran maze around the bottom, a band that made the divided skirt seem one when she was still. Another band curved becomingly across the bodice. Concern for her clothes, that they be pretty instead of just suitable, was certainly a small change, looking at it one way. She never took it to extremes. Yet in another it was as drastic as her face, and a puzzle. Swan resented the changes, and resisted them, except for this one. Liana, on the other hand, in true Aes Sedai fashion, embraced what had changed. A young woman again. Egwene had overheard a yellow exclaiming in wonder that both were prime childbearing age by everything she could find. She might never have been keeper, never have had any other face. The very image of practicality and efficiency became the ideal of an indolent and alluring Domani woman. Even her riding dress was cut in the style of her native land, and no matter that its silk, so thin it barely seemed opaque, was as impractical as the pale green color for traveling dusty roads. Told that having been stilled had broken all ties and associations, Liana had chosen the green Aja over a return to the blue. Changing Ajas was not done, but then no one had been stilled and then healed before either. Swan had gone right back into the blue, grumbling over the idiotic need to entreat and appeal for acceptance, as the formal phrase went. "Oh, light," Liana breathed, as she thumped onto the stool with considerably less than her usual grace. "We should have turned her over for trial the first day. Nothing we've learned from her is worth letting her loose on the world again. Nothing." It was a measure of her shock. She did not normally go about stating the obvious. Her brain had not grown indolent, whatever her outward demeanor. Languid and seductive Domani women might be on the outside, but they were still known as the sharpest traders anywhere. "Blood and bloody... we should have had her watched," Swan growled through her teeth. Egwene's eyebrows rose. Swan must be as shaken as Liana. "By who, Swan? Faelaine? Theodrin? They don't even know you two are of my party." A party? 5 women. And Faelaine and Theodrin were hardly eager adherents, especially Faelaine. Nynaeve and Elaine could be counted too, of course, and Birgitta, certainly, even if she was not Aes Sedai. But they were a long way off. Stealth and cunning were still her major strengths, plus the fact that no one expected them of her. How should I have explained to anyone why they were supposed to watch my serving woman? For that matter, what good would it have done? It had to be one of the Forsaken. Do you really think Faelaine and Theodrin together could have stopped him? I'm not sure I could have, even linked with Romanda and Lilaine. They were the next 2 strongest women in the camp, as strong in the power as Swan used to be. Swan visibly forced a scowl from her face, but even so she snorted. She often said that if she could no longer be Ammerlin, then she would teach Egwene how to be the best Ammerlin ever, yet the transition from lion on a hill to mouse underfoot was difficult. Egwene allowed her no little latitude because of that. "I want the 2 of you to ask about among those near the tent Mogedion was sleeping in. Someone must have seen the man. He had to come afoot. Anybody opening a gateway inside a space that little risked cutting her in 2, however small he wove it." Swan snorted, louder than the first time. "Why bother?" she growled. "Do you mean to go chasing after like some fool hero in a Glee Man's fool story and bring her back? Maybe tie up all the Forsaken at one go? Win the last battle while you're at it? Even if we get a description head to toe, nobody knows one Forsaken from another. Nobody here, anyway. It's the most bloody useless barrel of fish guts I ever—" "Swan," Egwene said sharply, sitting up straighter. Latitude was one thing, but there were limits. She did not put up with this even from Romanda. Color bloomed slowly in Swan's cheeks. Struggling to master herself, she kneaded her skirts and avoided Egwene's eyes. "Forgive me, Mother," she said finally. She almost sounded as if she meant it. "It's been a difficult day for her, Mother," Liana put in with an impish smile. She was very good at those, though she generally used them to set some man's heart racing. Not promiscuously, of course. She possessed discrimination and discretion in ample supply. But then most are. If she could only learn not to throw things at Gareth Bryn every time she gets angry. "Enough!" Egwene snapped. Liana was only trying to take a little of the pressure from Swan, but she was in no mood for it. "I want to know anything I can learn about whoever freed Mogedion, even if it's just whether he was short or tall. Any scrap that makes him less a shadow creeping in the dark, if that's not more than I have a right to ask." Liana sat quite still, staring at the flowers in the carpet in front of her toes. The redness spread to cover nearly Swan's whole face. With her fair skin, it made her look like a sunset. "I humbly beg your pardon, Mother." This time she did sound penitent. Her difficulty meeting Egwene's gaze was obvious. Sometimes it's hard to... Nope, no excuses. I humbly beg pardon. Egwene fingered her stole, letting the moment set itself as she looked at Swan without blinking. That was something Swan herself had taught her, but after a bit she shifted uneasily on the cot. When you knew you were in the wrong, silence pricked, and the pricks drove home that you were wrong. Silence was a very useful tool in a number of situations. "Since I can't recall what I should forgive," she said at last, quietly, "there seems to be no need. But, Swan, don't let it happen again." "Thank you, Mother." A hint of wry laughter curled the corners of Swan's mouth. "If I may say so, I seem to have taught you very well. But, if I may suggest..." She waited for Egwene's impatient nod. "One of us should carry your order to Phaelain or Theodrin to ask the questions, very sulky at being made a messenger. They'll occasion a deal less comment than Lyanna or I. Everyone knows you are their patron." Egwene agreed immediately. She still was not thinking clearly, or she would have seen that for herself. The headachy feeling was back again. Chesa claimed it came from too little sleep, but sleeping was difficult when your head felt taut as a drumhead. It would take a larger head than hers not to feel tight, stuffed with as many worries as she had. Well, at least now she could pass on the secrets that had kept Mogedion hidden, how to weave disguises with the power and how to mask your ability from other women who could channel. Revealing those had been too risky when they might have led to unmasking Mogedion. A bit more acclaim, she thought wryly. There had been great petting and exclaiming when she announced the once-lost secret of traveling, which at least had been her own, and more praise since for every one of the secrets she had wrenched out of Mogedion, like pulling a back tooth each time. None of the acclaim made an ounce of difference in her position, though. You could pat a talented child on the head without forgetting she was a child. Lyanna departed with a curtsy and a dry comment that she was not sorry somebody else would have less than a full night's rest for once. Swan waited. No one could be allowed to see her and Lyanna leaving together. For a time, Egwene merely studied the other woman. Neither spoke. Swan seemed lost in thought. Finally, she gave a start and stood, straightening her dress, plainly preparing to go. "Swan," Egwene began slowly, and found herself uncertain how to continue. Swan thought she understood. "You were not only right, Mother," she said, looking Egwene straight in the eye. "You were lenient. Too lenient, though I say it who shouldn't. You are the Ammerlin seat, and no one may be insolent or impertinent to you. If you'd given me a penance that made even Ramonda feel sorry for me, it would have been no more than I deserved." "I will remember that next time," Egwene said, and Swan bowed her head as if in acceptance. Maybe it was. Unless the changes in her ran deeper than seemed possible, there almost certainly would be a next time, and more after that. "But what I want to ask about is Lord Bryn." All expression vanished from Swan's face. "Are you sure you wouldn't like me to... intervene?" "Why would I want that, Mother?" Swan's voice was blander than cold water soup. "The only duties I have are teaching you the etiquette of your office and handing Shiriam reports from my eyes and ears." She still retained some of her former network, though it was doubtful any knew who their reports went to now. "Gareth Bryn hardly requires enough of my time to interfere with that." She almost always referred to him that way, and even when she used his title she put a bite into it. "Swan, a burned barn and a few cows couldn't cost that much. Not compared with paying and feeding all those soldiers, certainly. But she had offered before, and the stiff reply was the same. "I thank you, Mother, but no. I won't have him saying I break my word, and I swore to work the debt off." Abruptly, Swan's stiffness dissolved in laughter, rare when she spoke about Lord Bryn. Scowls were much more common. "If you need to worry about somebody, worry about him, not me. I need no help handling Gareth Bryn." And that was the strange part. Weak she might be in the One Power now, but not so weak that Swan had to keep on as his servant, spending hours up to her elbows in hot soapy water with his shirts and small clothes. Perhaps she did so in order to have someone at hand on whom she could loose the temper she was otherwise forced to keep in a sack. Whatever the reason, it occasioned no little talk, and confirmed her oddness in many eyes. She was Aes Sedai, after all, if rather far down. His methods of dealing with her temper, once she threw plates and boots anyway, outraged her and provoked threats of dire consequences. Yet though she could have wrapped him up unable to stir a finger, Swan never touched Sidar around him, not to do his chores, and not even when it meant being turned over his knee. That fact she had kept hidden from most so far, but some things slipped out when she was in a rage, or when Lyanna was in a humor. There seemed to be no explanation. Swan was not weak-spirited or a fool. She was neither meek nor afraid. She was not... You might as well be on your way, Swan. Clearly some secrets were not going to be revealed tonight. It's late, and I know you want your bed. Yes, Mother. And thank you, she added, though Egwene could not have said for what. After Swan left, Egwene rubbed her temples once more. She wanted to pace. The tent would not do it. It might be the largest in the camp occupied by just one person, but that meant less than two spans by two, and it was crowded with cot and chair and stool, washstand and stand mirror, and no fewer than three chests full of clothes. Chesa had seen to those last, and Shiriam and Ramonda and Lilaine and a dozen more sitters. They kept seeing to them. A few more gifts of silk shifts or stockings, one more dress grand enough to receive a king, and there would be need for a fourth chest. Maybe Shiriam and the sitters hoped all the fine dresses would blind her to anything else, but Chesa just thought the Ammerlin seat had to be clothed suitably for her station. Servants, it seemed, believed in following the correct rituals as much as the hall ever did. Shortly, Salaim would be there. It was her turn to undress Egwene for bed, another ritual. Only between her head and her restless feet, she was not ready for bed yet. Leaving the lamps burning, she hurried out before Salaim could arrive. Walking would clear her head, and maybe tire her enough that she could sleep soundly. Putting herself to sleep would be no problem. The Wise One Dreamwalkers had taught herself that skill early on. Yet finding any rest in it was another matter. Especially when her mind boiled with a list of worries that began with Ramonda and Lilaine and Shiriam, then ran through Rand, Elida, Mogedion, the weather, and on out of sight. She avoided the area near Mogedion's tent. If she asked questions herself, too much importance would be given to a servant running away. Discretion had become part of her. The game she played allowed few slips, and being careless where you knew it did not matter could lead to be careless where it did. Worse, you could discover you had been wrong about where it mattered. The weak must be bowled cautiously. That was Swan again. She truly did her best to teach, and she knew this particular game very well. There were no more people out and about in the moon-shadowed camp than there had been before. Handfuls slouched wearily around low fires, exhausted by their evening labors after a hard day's journey. Those who saw her rose tiredly to make their courtesies as she passed, murmuring, "The light shine on you, Mother," or something like, occasionally asking her blessing, which she gave with a simple, "The light bless you, my child." Men and women old enough to be her grandparents sat back down, beaming from that. Yet she wondered what they actually believed about her, what they knew. All the Aes Sedai presented an unbroken front to the outside world, including their own servants. But Swan said that if you believed a servant knew twice what he should, you only knew half the truth. Still, those bows and curtsies and murmurs followed her from one clump of people to the next, comforting her with the possibility that there were some at least who did not see her as a child the hall brought out when they needed her. As she passed an open area surrounded by ropes tied to posts driven into the ground, a gateway's silver slash of light flashed vivid in the darkness as it rotated open. It was not really light, though. It cast no shadows. She paused to watch beside a corner post. No one at the nearby fires even looked up. They were used to this by now. A dozen or more sisters, twice as many servants, and a number of warders bustled out, returning with messages and wicker cages of pigeons from the dovecots in Salidar, a good 500 miles west and south as the goose flew. They began scattering before the gateway closed, carrying their burdens to sitters, to their ajahs, a few back to their own tents. Most nights Swan would have been with them. She seldom trusted anyone else to fetch messages destined for her, even if most were in codes or ciphers. Sometimes the world seemed to hold more networks of eyes and ears than it did Aes Sedai, though most were severely truncated by circumstance. The majority of agents for the various Ajahs seemed to be lying low until the difficulties in the White Tower subsided, and a good many of the individual sisters' eyes and ears had no idea where the woman they served was at present. Several of the warders saw Egwene and made careful bows, with a respect proper to the stole. Sisters might eye her askance, but the hall had raised her Amarlin and the Gaidine needed no more. A number of the servants offered bows or curtsies, too. Not one of the Aes Sedai hurrying away from the gateway so much as glanced in her direction. Perhaps they did not notice her. Perhaps. In a way that anybody could still hear from any of their eyes and ears at all was one of Mogedion's gifts. The sisters with the strength to make gateways had all been in Salidar long enough to know it well. Those who could weave a gateway of useful size were able to travel almost anywhere from there and land right on the spot. Trying to travel to Salidar, however, would have meant spending half of each night learning the new roped-off patch of ground, more for some, every time they made camp. What Egwene had pried from Mogedion was a way to journey from a place you did not know well to one you did. Slower than traveling, skimming was not one of the lost talents. No one had ever heard of it, so even the name was credited to Egwene. Anyone who could travel could skim. So every night sisters skimmed to Salidar, checking the dovecotes for birds that had returned to where they had been hatched, then traveled back. The sight should have pleased her. The rebel Aes Sedai had gained talents the White Tower thought lost forever, as well as learned new ones, and those abilities would help cost Elida the Amarlin seat before all was done. Yet instead of pleasure, Egwene felt sourness. Being snubbed had nothing to do with it, or not much, anyway. As she walked on, the fires grew farther between, then faded behind. All around her lay the dark shapes of wagons, most with canvas tops stretched over iron hoops, and tents glowing palely in the moonlight. Beyond, the army's campfires climbed the surrounding hills all around, the stars brought to ground. The silence from Camelin tied her middle into knots, whatever anyone else thought. The very day they left Salidar, a message had arrived, though Shiryam had not bothered to show it to her until a few days ago, and then with repeated warnings on the need to keep the contents secret. The hall knew, but no one else must. More of the 10,000 secrets that infested the camp. Egwene was sure she'd never would have seen it if she had not kept going on about Rand. She could recall every carefully chosen word, written in a tiny hand on paper so thin it was a wonder the pen had not torn through. "We are well settled at the inn of which we spoke, and we have met with the wool merchant. He is a very remarkable young man, everything that Nynaeve told us. Still, he was courteous. I think he is somewhat afraid of us, which is to the good. It will go well. You may have heard rumors about men here, including a fellow from Saldaea. The rumors are all too true, I fear, but we have seen none of them and will avoid them if we can. If you pursue two hares, both will escape you. Verin and Alana are here, with a number of young women from the same region as the wool merchant. I will try to send them on to you for training. Alana has formed an attachment to the wool merchant, which may prove useful, though it is troubling, too. All will go well, I am sure. Mirana." Shiryam emphasized the good news as she saw it. Mirana, an experienced negotiator, had reached Camelin and been well received by Rand, the wool merchant. Wonderful news to Shiryam. And Verin and Alana would be bringing Two Rivers girls to become novices. Shiryam was sure they must be coming down the same road they themselves were headed up. She seemed to think Egwene would be all aglow at the expectation of seeing faces from home. Mirana would handle everything. Mirana knew what she was doing. "That's a bucket of horse sweat," Egwene muttered at the night. A gap-toothed fellow carrying a large wooden bucket gave a start and gaped at her, so amazed he forgot to bow. "Rand? Courteous?" She had seen his first meeting with Coiran Saildane, Elida's emissary. Overbearing summed it up nicely. Why should he be different with Mirana? And Mirana thought he was afraid, thought that was good. Rand was seldom afraid, even when he should be, And if he was now, Mirana should remember that fear could make the mildest man dangerous. Remember that Rand was dangerous just being who he was. And what was this attachment Alana had formed? Egwene did not entirely trust Alana. The woman did extremely odd things at times, maybe impetuously and maybe with some deeper motive. Egwene would not put it past her to find a way into Rand's bed. He would be clay in the hands of a woman like her. Elaine would break Alana's neck if that was so, but that was the least of it. Worst of all, no more of the pigeons Mirana had taken with her had appeared in the Salidar dovecotes. Mirana should have had some word to send, if only that she and the rest of the embassy had gone to Cairhien. Lately the Wise Ones did little more than acknowledge Rand was alive, yet it seemed he was there, sitting on his hands as far as she could make out. Which should have been a warning beacon. Shiriam saw it differently. Who could say why any man did what he did? Probably not even the man himself, most of the time, and when it came to one who could channel. Silence proved all was well. Mirana surely would have reported any real difficulty. She must be on her way to Cairhien, if not there already, and there was no need to report further until she could send word of success. For that matter, Rand in Cairhien was success of a sort. One of Mirana's goals, if not the most important, had been to ease him out of Camelin, so that Elaine could return there safely and take the Lion Throne, and the dangers of Cairhien had dissipated. Incredible as it seemed, the Wise One said Corrin and her embassy had left the city on their way back to Tar Valon. Or maybe not so incredible. It all made a sort of sense, given Rand, given the way Aes Sedai did things. Even so, to Egwene, it all felt wrong. "I have to go to him," she muttered. 1 hour, and she could straighten everything out. "I have to go to him," she muttered. 1 hour, and she could straighten everything out. Underneath, he was still Rand. That's all there is to it. I have to go to him. That isn't possible, and you know it. If Egwene had not had herself on a tight rein, she would have jumped a foot. As it was, her heart pounded even after she made out Lyanna by the light of the moon. "I thought you were," she said, before she could stop herself, and only just managed not to say Mogedion's name. The taller woman fell in beside her, keeping a careful watch for other sisters as they walked. Lyanna did not have Swan's excuse for spending time with her. Not that being seen together once should cause any harm, but should not isn't always will not, Egwene reminded herself. Slipping the stole from her shoulders, she folded it to carry in one hand. At a glance from a distance, Lyanna might well be taken for an accepted, despite her dress. Many accepted lacked enough of the banded white dresses to wear one all the time. From a distance, Egwene might be taken for one, too. Not the most pacifying thought. "Theodrin and Fairlane are asking around near Marigan's tent, Mother. They weren't especially pleased. I did a fine sulk over carrying messages, if I do say so. Theodrin had to stop Fairlane dressing me down for it." Lyanna's laughter was quiet and breathy. Situations that grated Swan's teeth usually amused her. She was cosseted by most of the other sisters for how well she had adjusted. "Good, good," Egwene said absently. "Mirana misstepped somehow, Lyanna, or he wouldn't be staying in Cairhien and she wouldn't be keeping quiet." Off in the distance a dog bayed at the moon, then others, until they were abruptly silenced by shouts that perhaps luckily she could not quite understand. A number of the soldiers had dogs tagging along. There were none in the Aes Sedai camp. Any number of cats, but no dogs. "Mirana does know what she is doing, Mother." It sounded very like a sigh. Lyanna and Swan both agreed with Shiriam. Everyone did, except her. "When you give someone a task, you have to trust it to them." Egwene sniffed and folded her arms. "Lyanna, that man could strike sparks from a damp cloth if it wore the shawl. I don't know Mirana, but I've never seen an Aes Sedai who qualified as a damp cloth." "I've met one or two," Lyanna chuckled. This time her sigh was plain. "But not Mirana, true. Does he really believe he has friends inside the tower? Alviarin? That might make him difficult for Mirana, I suppose. But I can hardly see Alviarin doing anything to risk her place. She was always ambitious enough for three." "He says he has a letter from her." She could still see Rand gloating over receiving letters from Elida and Alviarin both, back before she herself left Cairhien. Maybe her ambitions make her think she can replace Elida with him on her side. That's if she really wrote it, if it exists. He thinks he's clever, Lyanna. Maybe he is. But he doesn't believe he needs anyone. Rand would go on thinking he could handle anything by himself right up until one of those anythings crushed him. I know him inside and out, Lyanna. Being around the Wise Ones seems to have infected him, or maybe he infected them. Whatever the sitters think, whatever any of you think, an Aes Sedai's shawl doesn't impress him any more than it does the Wise Ones. Sooner or later he'll exasperate a sister until she does something about it, or one of them will push him the wrong way, not realizing how strong he is and what his temper is now. After that, there might be no going back. I'm the only one who can deal with him safely. The only one. He can hardly be as irritating as those Aiel women, Lyanna murmured wryly. Even she found it difficult to be amused by her experiences with the Wise Ones. But it hardly matters. The Ammerlin seat being valued with the White Tower itself. A pair of women appeared between the tents ahead, moving slowly as they talked. Distance and shadow obscured their faces, yet it was clear they were Aes Sedai from the way they carried themselves, an assurance that nothing hiding in any darkness could harm them. No accepted on the brink of the shawl could manage quite that degree of confidence. A queen with an army at her back might not. They were coming toward her and Lyanna. Lyanna quickly turned in to the deeper dimness between two wagons. Scowling with frustration, Egwene nearly pulled her out again and marched on. Let it all come into the open. She would stand before the hall and tell them it was time they realized the Ammerlin's stole was more than a pretty scarf. She would... Following Lyanna, she motioned the other woman to walk on. What she would not do was throw everything on the midden heap in a fit of pique. Only one tower law specifically limited the power of the Ammerlin seat. A fistful of irritating customs and a barrel full of inconvenient realities, but only one law, yet it could not have been a worse for her purposes. The Ammerlin seat being valued with the White Tower itself as the very heart of the White Tower, she must not be endangered without dire necessity. Therefore, unless the White Tower be at war by declaration of the Hall of the Tower, the Ammerlin seat shall seek the lesser consensus of the Hall of the Tower before deliberately placing herself in the way of any danger, and she shall abide by the consensus that stands. What rash incident by an Ammerlin had inspired that, Egwene did not know, but it had been law for something over 2,000 years. To most Aes Sedai, any law that old attained an aura of holiness. Changing it was unthinkable. Romanda had quoted that bloody law as though lecturing a half-wit. If the daughter heir of Andor could not be allowed within 100 miles of the dragon reborn, how much more they must preserve the Ammerlin seat. Lelaine sounded almost regretful, most likely because she was agreeing with Romanda. That had nearly curdled both their tongues. Without them, both of them, the lesser consensus lay as far out of reach as the greater. Light, even that declaration of war only required the lesser consensus. So if she could not obtain permission... Lyanna cleared her throat. You can hardly do much if you go in secret, Mother, and the hall will find out, soon or late. I think you would find it difficult to have an hour to yourself after that. Not that they dare put a guard on you, precisely, but there are ways. I can quote examples from certain sources. She never mentioned the hidden records directly unless they were behind a ward. Am I so transparent? Egwene asked after a moment. There were only wagons around them here, and beneath the wagons the dark mounds of sleeping wagon drivers and horse handlers and all the rest needed to keep so many vehicles moving. It was remarkable just how many conveyances over 300 Aes Sedai required, when few would condescend to ride even a mile in wagon or cart. But there were tents and furnishings and foodstuffs, and 1,000 things needed to keep the sisters and those who served them. The loudest sounds here were snores, a chorus of frogs. No, Mother, Lyanna laughed softly. I just thought what I would do. But it's well known I've lost all my dignity and sense. The Ammerlin seat can hardly take me for a model. I think you must let young Master Al-Thor go as he will, for a time anyway, while you pluck the goose that's in front of you. His way may lead us all to the pit of doom, Egwene muttered, but it was not an argument. There had to be a way to pluck that goose and still keep Rand from making dangerous mistakes, but she could not see it now. Not frogs. Those snores sounded like 100 saws cutting logs full of knots. This is as bad a spot for a soothing walk as I've ever visited. I think I might as well go to bed. Lyanna tilted her head. In that case, Mother, if you will forgive me, there's a man in Lord Bryn's camp. After all, whoever heard of a green without even one warder? From the sudden quickening in her voice, you might have thought she was off to meet a lover. Considering what Egwene had heard about greens, perhaps there was not that much difference. Back among the tents, the last of the fires had been doused with dirt. No one took risks with fire when the countryside was tinder dry. A few tendrils of smoke rose lazily in the moonlight where the job had not been well done. A man murmured drowsily in his sleep inside a tent, and here and there a cough drifted out or a rasping snore, but otherwise the camp lay silent and still. Which was why Egwene was surprised when someone stepped from the shadows in front of her, especially someone wearing the simple white dress of a novice. "Mother, I need to speak to you." "Nicola?" Egwene had made a point of fixing name to face for every novice, no easy chore given how sisters hunted all along the army's path for girls and young women who could learn. Active search was still not well thought of. Custom was to wait for the girl to ask, best of all to wait for her to come to the tower. But 10 times as many novices studied in the camp now as the White Tower had held in years. Nicola was one to be remembered, though, and besides, Egwene had often noticed the young woman staring at her. "Tiana won't be pleased if she finds you up this late." Tiana Nozella was the mistress of novices, known equally for a comforting shoulder when a novice needed to cry, and an unyielding stance when it came to rules. The other woman shifted as if to hurry away, then straightened her back. Sweat glistened on her cheeks. The darkness was cooler than the light had been, but not what anyone would call cool, and the simple trick of ignoring heat or cold came only with the shawl. "I know I'm supposed to ask to see Tiana Sedai and then ask her to see you, Mother, but she'd never let a novice approach the Ammerlin seat." "About what, child?" Egwene asked. The woman was older by 6 or 7 years at least, but that was the proper address for a novice. Fidgeting with her skirt, Nicola stepped closer. Large eyes met Egwene's, perhaps more directly than a novice's should have. "Mother, I want to go as far as I can." Her hands plucked at her dress, but her voice was cool and self-possessed, fit for an Aes Sedai. "I won't say they are holding me back, but I am sure I can become stronger than they say. I just know I can. You were never held back, Mother. No one has ever gained so much of her strength as fast as you. All I ask is the same chance." Movement in the shadow behind Nicola turned into another sweaty-faced woman, this one in short coat and wide trousers, carrying a bow. Her hair hung to her waist in a braid tied with 6 ribbons, and she wore short boots with raised heels. Nicola Trehill and Arena Nirmasiv seemed an odd pair to be friends. Like many of the older novices, women with nearly 10 years on Egwene were tested now, though many sisters still grumbled that they were 10 years too old to accept novice discipline. Like many of those older women, Nicola was ferocious in her desire to learn, by all reports, and she had a potential bettered only by Nynaeve, Elaine, and Egwene herself among living Aes Sedai. In fact, Nicola apparently was making great strides, often great enough that her teachers had to slow her down. Some said she had begun picking up weaves as if she already knew them. Not only that, but she already demonstrated 2 talents, although the ability to see Ta'veren was minor, while the major talent, foretelling, emerged so that no one understood what she had foretold. She herself did not remember a word she said. All in all, Nicola was already marked by the sisters as someone to watch, despite her late start. The begrudging agreement to test women older than 17 or 18 probably could be laid at Nicola's feet. Arena, on the other hand, was a hunter for the horn who swaggered as much as a man and sat around talking of adventures, those she had had and those she would, when she was not practicing with her bow. Very likely she had picked that weapon up from Birgitta, along with her manner of dress. She certainly seemed to have no interest in anything beside the bow, except flirting occasionally in a rather forward manner, though not lately. Perhaps long days on the road left her too tired for it, if not for archery. Why she was still traveling with them, Egwene could not understand. It was hardly likely that Arena believed the Horn of Valir would turn up along their march, and impossible that she even suspected it was hidden away inside the White Tower. Very few people knew that. Egwene was not certain even Elida did. Arena seemed a posturing fool, but Egwene felt a certain sympathy for Nicola. She understood the woman's discontent, understood wanting to know it all now. She had been that way, too. Maybe she still was. "Nicola," she said gently, We all have limits. I'll never match Nynaeve Sedai, for example, whatever I do. But if I could only have the chance, Mother... Nicola actually wrung her hands in pleading, and there was a touch of it in her voice, yet her eyes still met Egwene's levelly. The chance you had. What I did, because I had no choice, because I didn't know better, is called forcing Nicola, and it is dangerous. She had not heard that term until Swan apologized for doing it to her. That was one time Swan truly had seemed repentant. You know if you try to channel more of Sidar than you're ready to handle, you risk burning yourself out before you ever come close to your full strength. Best you learn to be patient. The sisters won't let you be anything else until you are ready anyway. We came to Salidar on the same riverboat as Nynaeve and Elaine, Arena said suddenly. Her gaze was more than direct. It was challenging. And Birgitta. For some reason, she said the name bitterly. Nicola made shushing motions. There's no need to bring that up. Oddly, she did not sound as if she meant it. Hoping she was keeping her face half so smooth as Nicola's, Egwene tried to quell a sudden uneasiness. Marigan had come to Salidar on that boat, too. An owl hooted, and she shivered. Some people thought hearing an owl in moonlight meant bad news was coming. She was not superstitious, but... No need to bring up what? The other two women exchanged looks, and Arena nodded. It was on the walk from the river to the village. For all her supposed reluctance, Nicola peered straight into Egwene's eyes. Arena and I heard Tom Marilyn and Juelin Sandar talking, the Glee Man and the Thief Taker. Juelin said if there were Aes Sedai in the village, we weren't sure yet, and they learned Nynaeve and Elaine had been pretending to be Aes Sedai, then we were all jumping into a school of Silver Pike, which I take it isn't very safe. The Glee Man saw us and hushed him, Arena put in, fingering the quiver at her waist. But we heard. Her voice was hard as her stare. I know they're both Aes Sedai now, Mother, but wouldn't they still be in trouble if anyone found out? The sisters, I mean? Anyone who pretends to be a sister is in trouble if they find out, even years later. Nicola's face did not change, but her gaze suddenly seemed to be trying to fix Egwene's. She leaned a little forward, intent. Anybody at all? Isn't that so? Emboldened by Egwene's silence, Arena grinned, an unpleasant grin in the night. I hear Nynaeve and Elaine were sent out of the tower on some task by the Sanche woman back when she was Ammerlin. I hear you were sent off by her too at the same time. Got into all sorts of trouble when you came back. Sly insinuation slithered into her voice. Do you remember them playing at Aes Sedai? They stood there looking at her, Arena leaning insolently on her bow, Nicola so expectant the air should have crackled. Swan Sanche is Aes Sedai, Egwene said coldly, and so are Nynaeve Almira and Elaine Trakand. You will show them proper respect. To you they are Swan Sedai, Nynaeve Sedai, and Elaine Sedai. The pair blinked in surprise. Inside her stomach quivered with outrage. After everything she had been through tonight, she was confronted with blackmail from these. She could not think of a word bad enough. Elaine could have. Elaine listened to stablemen and wagon drivers and every sort, memorizing the words she should have refused to hear. Unfolding the striped stole, Egwene draped it carefully across her shoulders. I don't think you understand, Mother, Nicola said hastily. Not fearfully, however, just attempting to force her point. I merely worried that if anyone found out that you had... Egwene gave her no chance to go further. Oh, I understand, child. The fool woman was a child, however old she was. Any number of the older novices gave trouble, usually in the form of insolence toward accepted, set to teach them, but even the silliest had sense enough to avoid impertinence to the sisters. It fanned her anger to white heat that the woman had the gall to try this on with her. They were both taller than she, if not by much, but she planted her fists on her hips and drew herself up, and they shrank away as though she loomed. Do you have any notion how serious it is to bring charges against a sister, especially for a novice? Charges based on a conversation you claim to have heard between men now 1,000 miles away? Tiana would skin you alive and put you to scrubbing pots the rest of your natural life. Nicola kept trying to push a word in. Apologies, they sounded like this time, and more protests that Egwene did not understand. Frantic attempts to change everything. but Egwene ignored her and rounded on Arena. The hunter took another step back, wetting her lips and looking remarkably uncertain. "You needn't think you would walk away clear, either. Even a hunter could be hauled to Tiana for a thing like this. If you're lucky enough not to be flogged at a wagon tongue, the way they do soldiers caught stealing. Either way, you'll be tossed out by the road with your welts for company." Drawing a deep breath, Egwene folded her hands at her waist. Clutched together, they would not tremble. All but cowering, the pair looked suitably chastened. She hoped those downcast eyes and slumped shoulders and shifting feet were not feigned. By rights, she should send them to Tiana right now. She had no idea what the penalty might be for trying to blackmail the Ammerlin seat, but it seemed likely that being turned out of the camp would be the least of it. In Nicola's case, the turning out would have to wait until her teachers were satisfied she knew enough of channeling not to hurt herself or others by accident. Nicola Trehill would never be Aes Sedai, though, once that charge was laid against her. All that potential would go for nothing. Except, any woman caught pretending to be Aes Sedai was set down so hard she would still be whimpering years later, and an accepted caught might very well consider the other woman fortunate. But surely Nynaeve and Elaine were safe, now they really were sisters, herself as well. Only, it might take no more than a whisper of this to erase any chance of making the hall acknowledge her truly the Ammerlin seat. As well jaunt off to Rand, and then tell the hall to their faces. She dared not allow these two to see her doubt, or even suspect. "I will forget this," she said sharply. "But if I hear so much as a whisper of it again from anyone..." She drew a ragged breath. If she heard shouts of it, there might be little she could do. But by the way they jumped, they read a threat that pricked deep. "Get to your beds before I change my mind." In an instant they became a flurry of curtsies of "Yes, Mother," and "No, Mother," and "As you command, Mother." They scurried away, looking back over their shoulders at her, every step faster than the last, until they were running. She had to walk on sedately, but she wanted to run, too. Chapter 10 Unseen Eyes. Selaim was waiting when Egwene got back to her tent, a rail-thin woman with dark Tyran coloring and a nearly impervious self-assurance. Chesa was right. She did carry her long nose raised, as though recoiling from a bad smell. Yet, if her manner with the other maids was arrogant, she was in reality quite different around her patroness. As Egwene entered, Selaim folded herself into a curtsy so deep her head nearly brushed the carpet, skirts spread as wide as they would go in the cramped quarters. Before Egwene had taken her second step inside, the woman leaped up, fussing over her buttons, and fussing over her, too. Selaim had very little sense. "Oh, Mother, you went out with your head uncovered again!" As if she had ever worn any of those beaded caps the woman favored, or the embroidered velvet things Mary favored, or Chase's plumed hats. "Why, you're shivering. You should never go walking out of doors without a shawl and parasol, Mother." How was a parasol supposed to stop shivering? With sweat trickling down her own cheeks, however fast she dabbed with her handkerchief, Selaim never thought to ask why she shivered, which was perhaps just as well. "And you went alone in the night? It just isn't proper, Mother. Besides, there are all those soldiers, rough men, with no decent respect for any woman, even Aes Sedai. Mother, you simply mustn't." Egwene let the foolish words wash over her in the same way she let the woman undress her, paying less than half a mind. Ordering her to be quiet would only produce so many hurt looks and abused sighs that it made little difference. Except for the brainless chatter, Selaim performed her duties diligently, if with so many flourishes they became a dance of grand gestures and obsequious curtsies. It seemed impossible that anyone could be as silly as Selaim, always concerned with appearances, always worrying over what people would think. To her, people were Aes Sedai and the nobility, and their upper servants. By her book, no one else mattered. Perhaps no one else thought by her book. It probably was impossible. Egwene was not about to forget who had found Selaim in the first place, any more than she did who had found Mary. True, Chesa was a gift from Shiriam, but Chesa had shown her loyalties to Egwene more than once. Egwene wanted to tell herself the tremors that the other woman took for shivers were quivers of rage, yet she knew a worm of fear writhed in her belly. She had come too far, had too much to do yet, to allow Nicola and Irena to put a spoke through her wheels. As her head popped through the top of a clean shift, she caught a bit of the skinny woman's prattle and stared. "Did you say ewe's milk?" "Oh, yes, Mother. Your skin is so soft, and nothing will keep it that way like bathing in ewe's milk." Maybe she really was an idiot. Hustling a protesting Salame out, Egwene brushed her own hair, turned down her own cot, placed the now useless Idom bracelet in the small carved ivory box where she kept her few pieces of jewelry, then extinguished the lamps. "All by myself," she thought sarcastically in the darkness. "Salame and Mary will have conniptions." Before retiring, however, she padded to the entrance and opened a small gap in the door flaps. Outside was moonlit stillness and silence, broken by a night heron's cry that suddenly cut off in a shriek. There were hunters abroad in the darkness. After a moment, something moved in the shadows beside a tent across the way. It looked like a woman. Perhaps idiocy did not disqualify Salame any more than dour-faced gloom eliminated Mary. It could be either one, or someone else entirely. Even Nicola or Irena, however unlikely. She let the tent flap fall shut with a smile. Whoever the watcher was would not see where she went tonight. The way the wise ones had taught her to put herself to sleep was simple. Eyes closed, feeling each part of the body relax in turn, breathing in time with her heartbeat, mind unfocused and drifting, all but one tiny corner, drifting. Sleep swept over her in moments, but it was the sleep of a dreamwalker. Formless, she floated deep within an ocean of stars, infinite points of light glimmering in an infinite sea of darkness, fireflies beyond counting flickering in an endless night. Those were dreams, the dreams of everyone sleeping anywhere in the world, maybe of everyone in all possible worlds, and this was the gap between reality and Telairun Riod, the space separating the waking world from the world of dreams. Wherever she looked, 10,000 fireflies vanished as people woke, and 10,000 new were born to replace them. A vast, ever-changing array of sparkling beauty. She did not waste time in admiration, though. This place held dangers, some deadly. She was sure she knew how to avoid those, but one peril in this place aimed straight at her if she lingered too long, and being caught in it would be embarrassing, to say the least. Keeping a wary eye out, well, it would have been a wary eye had she had eyes here, she moved. She had no sense of motion. It seemed she stood still, and that glittering ocean swirled around her until one light settled before her. Every twinkling star looked exactly like every other, yet she knew this was Nynaeve's dream. How she knew was another matter. Not even the wise ones understood that recognition. She had considered trying to find Nicola's dreams and Irena's. Once she unearthed them, she knew exactly how to sink the fear of the light into their bones, and she did not give a fig that every bit of it was prescribed. Practicality sent her here instead, not fear of the forbidden. She had done what was not done before, and she was certain she would again should it become necessary. Do what you must, then pay the price for it, was what she had been taught by the same women who had marked off those forbidden areas. It was refusal to admit the debt, refusal to pay, that often turned necessity to evil. But even if that pair were asleep, locating someone's dreams the first time was arduous at best, without guarantees. Days of efforts, nights of it rather, were more likely to deliver nothing. This was at least sure. Slowly she moved closer through everlasting darkness, though once again it seemed that she stayed still and the pinpoint of light grew to a glowing pearl, an iridescent apple, a full moon, until it filled her vision entirely with brightness, all the world. She did not touch it, though, not yet. A space finer than a hair remained between. Ever so gently she reached across that gap. With what, lacking a body, was as much a mystery as how she knew one dream from another. Her will, the wise ones said, but she still did not understand how that could be. As though laying a finger to a soap bubble, she kept her touch very delicate indeed. The shining wall shimmered like spun glass, pulsed like a heart, delicate and alive. A little firmer touch and she would be able to see inside, see what Nynaeve was dreaming. A bit firmer still and she could actually step inside and be a part of the dream. That carried hazards, especially with anyone of a strong mind, but either looking in or stepping in could be mortifying. For example, if the dreamer happened to be dreaming of a man she was particularly interested in. Apologies alone took half the night when you did that. Or, with a hooking sort of motion, like rolling a fragile bead across a tabletop, she could snatch Nynaeve out into a dream of her own making, a part of Telairan Riod itself, where she was in complete control. She was sure that would work. Of course, that was one of the forbidden things, and she did not think Nynaeve would appreciate it. Nynaeve, this is Egwene. Under no circumstances are you to return until you find the bowl. Not until I can settle a problem with Arena and Nicola. They know you were pretending. I will explain more when I see you next in the little tower. Be careful, Mogedion has escaped. The dream winked out. The soap bubble pricked. Despite the message, she would have giggled had she possessed a throat. A disembodied voice in your dream could have a startling effect, especially if you were afraid the speaker might be peeking. Nynaeve was not one to forget, even when it was an accident. That light-spangled sea whirled about her once more until she settled on another sparkling pinpoint, Elaine. The two women very likely slept no more than a dozen paces apart in Ebu Dar, but distance had no meaning here, or perhaps it had a different meaning. This time, when she delivered her message, the dream pulsed and changed. It still appeared exactly the same as every other, but even so, to her, it was transformed. Had the words drawn Elaine into another dream? They would remain, however, and she would remember on waking. With Nicola and Arena's bowstrings dampened a little more, it was time to turn her attention to Rand. Unfortunately, finding his dreams would be as useless as finding an Aes Sedai's. He shielded his somewhat as they did theirs, although apparently a man's shield differed from a woman's. An Aes Sedai's shield was a crystal carapace, a seamless sphere woven of spirit, but however transparent it appeared, it might as well have been steel. She could not recall how many fruitless hours she had frittered away trying to peer through his. Where a sister's shielded dream seemed brighter close up, his were dimmer. It was like staring into muddy water. Sometimes you had the impression that something had moved deep in those gray-brown swirls, but you could never tell what. Again the endless array of lights spun and settled, and she approached a third woman's dream, gingerly. So much lay between her and Amis that it seemed akin to approaching her mother's dreams. In truth, she had to admit, she wanted to emulate Amis in many ways. She desired Amis's respect every bit as greatly as she did the Hall's. Maybe, if she had to choose, she would choose Amis's. Certainly there was no sitter she esteemed as highly as she did Amis. Pushing away a sudden diffidence, she tried to make her voice softer, to no avail. "Amis, this is Egwene. I must speak with you." "We will come," a voice murmured to her, Amis's voice. Startled, Egwene backed away. She felt like laughing at herself. Perhaps it was just as well to be reminded that the wise ones had long years more experience at this. There were times she was afraid she might have been spoiled by not having to work harder for her abilities with the one power. Then again, as if to make up for it, sometimes everything else seemed like trying to climb a cliff in a rainstorm. Abruptly, she caught movement at the very edge of her field of vision. One of those points of light slid through the sea of stars, drifting toward her of its own volition, growing larger. Only one dream would do that. One dreamer. In a panic, she fled, wishing she had a throat to scream or curse or just shout, especially at the tiny corner of her that wanted to stay where she was and wait. Not even the stars moved this time. They simply disappeared. And she was leaning against a thick redstone column, panting as though she had sprinted a mile, heart beating fit to burst. After a moment she looked down at herself and began to laugh a trifle unsteadily, trying to catch her breath. She had on a full-skirted gown of shimmering green silk, worked in thread of gold in wide ornate bands across the bodice and along the hem. That bodice also showed considerably more bosom than she ever would waking, and a broad cinched belt of woven gold made her waist seem smaller than it really was. Then again, maybe it was smaller. Here in Telairan Riod you could be however you wanted, whatever you wanted, even when the wanting was unconscious if you were not careful. Gawain Trakand had unfortunate effects on her, very unfortunate. That tiny part of her still wished she had waited to be overtaken by his dream. overtaken and absorbed by it. If a dreamwalker loved somebody to distraction, or hated them beyond reason, most especially if the emotion was returned, she could be pulled into that person's dream. She drew the dream, or it drew her, as a lodestone drew iron filings. She certainly did not hate Gawain, but she could not afford to be trapped in his dream, not tonight. Trapped until he wakened, being as he saw her. Which was a good deal more beautiful than she truly was. Oddly, he appeared less beautiful than he was in life. There was no question of a strong mind or concentration when love or hate that strong was involved. Once you were in that dream, there you remained until the other person stopped dreaming about you. Remembering what he dreamed of doing with her, what they had done in his dreams, she felt a fiery blush suffusing her face. "A good thing none of the sitters can see me now," she muttered. "They'd never take me for anything but a girl then." Grown women did not flutter and moon over a man this way. She was certain of that. Not women with any sense, anyway. What he dreamed of would come, but at a time of her choosing. Obtaining her mother's permission might be difficult, yet surely she would not withhold it, even if she had never laid eyes on Gawain. Maren Alvear trusted her daughter's judgment. Now it was time for her youngest daughter to show a little of that judgment and put these fancies away until a better time. Looking around, she almost wished she could go on letting Gawain fill her thoughts. More massive columns ran in every direction, supporting a soaring vaulted ceiling and a great dome. None of the gilded lamps hanging from golden chains overhead was lit, yet there was light of a sort, light that was just there, without source, neither bright nor dim. The heart of the stone, inside the great fortress called the Stone of Tyr, or rather its image in Tel Arun-Riod, an image as real as the original in many ways. This was where she had met the wise ones before, their choice. A strange one for Aiel, it seemed to her. She would have expected Roydion, now that it was open, or somewhere else in the Aiel waste, or simply wherever the wise ones happened to be. Every place except Ogier Steading had its reflection in the world of dreams. Even the Steading did really, but they could not be entered, just as Roydion had once been closed. The Aes Sedai camp was out of the question, of course. A number of the sisters now had access to Turangreal that allowed them to enter the world of dreams, and since none really knew what they were doing, they often began their ventures by appearing in the camp of Tel Arun-Riod, as though setting out on a normal journey. Like Angreal and Saangreal, by Tower law, Turangreal were the property of the White Tower, no matter who happened to possess them for the present. Very seldom did the Tower insist, at least when possession lay somewhere like the so-called Great Holding in this very Stone of Tyr. Eventually they would come to the Aes Sedai, and the White Tower had always been good at waiting when it needed to. But those actually in Aes Sedai hands were in the gift of the Hall of individual sitters. The loan, really. They were almost never given. Elaine had learned to duplicate Dream Turangreal, and she and Nynaeve had taken two with them, but the rest were in the Hall's possession now, along with the other sorts Elaine had made. Which meant that Shiriam and her little circle could use them whenever they wished, and most assuredly Lelaine and Romanda, though it was likely those two sent others instead of entering Tel Arun-Riod themselves. Until quite recently, no Aes Sedai had walked the dream in centuries, and they still had considerable difficulties, most of which stemmed from a belief that they could learn by themselves. Even so, the last thing Egwene wanted was any of their followers spying on this meeting tonight. As though the thought of spies had made her more sensitive, she became aware of being watched by unseen eyes. That sensation was always present in Tel Arun-Riod, and not even the wise ones knew why. But although hidden eyes always seemed to be there, actual watchers might be present as well. It was not Romanda or Lelaine on her mind now. Trailing her hand against the column, she walked all the way around it slowly, studying the redstone forest as it ran away in deepening shadows. The light surrounding her was not real. Anybody in one of those shadows would see the same light around them while shadows hid her. People did appear, men and women, flickering images that rarely lasted more than a few heartbeats. She had no interest in those who touched the world of dreams in their sleep. Anyone might do that by happenstance, but luckily for them, only for moments, seldom long enough to face any of the dangers. The Black Aja possessed Dream Turangreal too, stolen from the tower. Worse, Mogedion knew Telairunriod as well as any dreamwalker. Perhaps better. She could control this place and anyone in it as easily as turning her hand. For a moment, Egwene wished she'd spied on Mogedion's dreams while the woman was prisoner, just once, just enough to be able to distinguish them. But even identifying her dreams would not reveal where she was now. And there had been the possibility of being drawn in against her will. She certainly despised Mogedion enough, and the Forsaken most assuredly hated her without bounds. What happened in there was not real, not even as real as in Telairunriod, but you remembered it as if it was. A night in Mogedion's power would have been a nightmare she likely would have relived every time she went to sleep for the rest of her life. Maybe awake, too. Another circuit. What was that? A dark, regally beautiful woman in pearl-covered cap and lace-ruffed gown strode from the shadows and vanished. A Tyran woman dreaming, a high lady, or dreaming herself as one. She might be plain and dumpy, a farm wife or a merchant, awake. Better to have spied on Loghain than Mogedion. She still would not know where he was, but she might have some idea of his plans. Of course, being pulled into his dream might not have been much more pleasant than being drawn into Mogedion's. He hated all Aes Sedai. Arranging his escape had been one of those necessary things. She just hoped the price would not be too high. Forget Loghain. Mogedion was the danger. Mogedion who might come after her, even here, especially here. Mogedion who... Suddenly she became aware of how heavily she was moving, and made a vexed sound in her throat, very nearly a groan. The beautiful gown had become a full set of plate and mail armor like that of Gareth Bryn's heavy cavalry. An open-faced helmet rested on her head, with a crest in the shape of the flame of Tar Valon by the feel. It was very irritating. She was beyond this sort of lack of control. Firmly she changed the armor to what she had worn meeting the Wise Ones before. It was just a matter of thought. Full skirt of dark wool and loose white Al-Ghoda blouse, just as she had worn while studying with them, complete with a fringed shawl so green it was nearly black, and a folded headscarf to hold her hair back. She did not duplicate their jewelry, of course, all the multitudes of necklaces and bracelets. They would laugh at her for that. A woman built her collection over the years, not in the blink of a dream. "Loghain is on his way to the Black Tower," she said aloud. She certainly hoped he was. At least there would be some check on him then, or so she hoped. And if he was caught and gentled again, Rand could not blame any sister following her. "And Mogedion has no way of knowing where I am." That, she tried to make sound a certainty. "Why should you fear the Shadow Sold?" asked a voice behind her, and Egwene tried to climb into the air. This being Telairunriod, and she a dreamwalker, she was more than her own height above the floorstones before she came to herself. "Oh, yes," she thought, floating. "I'm far beyond all those beginner's mistakes." If this went on, next she would be jumping when Chesa gave her good morning. Hoping she was not blushing too badly, she let herself settle slowly. Perhaps she could retain a little dignity. Perhaps. Yet Bear's aged face had more creases than usual, from a grin that seemed nearly to touch her ears.